Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Namaste Radio. The intent of our programming is to increase awareness, inspire loving action, and ignite transformation and healing in our listeners, and through them, our world. Namaste Radio is brought to you by Namaste Publishing. Please join its interactive spiritual community. Communicate directly with authors, guest bloggers, and others like yourself who are spiritually seeking a better way of living. Connect, make friends, and be one with our new Namaste Global community at namastepublishing.com. And now, please welcome your host for this hour, Marie Bernard, on Namaste Radio, radio that will change your life.
And welcome to Namaste Radio. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thank you so much for joining us today. And today's guest is David Sarita, back for a second three-hour special discussion. And today we're going to be starting out with a more in-depth discussion on the topic of singularity, which we ended the previous show with, and David would like to get much deeper into that. Hi, David.
Hi, Marie. Good to be back on your show.
Thank you so much. Welcome to the show. We appreciate your time so much. I know you're getting ready to have a little one soon.
Yeah.
Excited?
Very, very soon. I mean, it could happen in about 2 weeks from now that the window opens up when the birth could take place at any time.
Wow.
So I'm very, very excited. I'm 49 years old, so it took me a long time to become a father.
Aw. Well, congratulations. We're looking forward to it, and maybe you'll share some pictures on Facebook when you're ready.
Yeah.
So, David, last time we wrapped up the show with the topic of singularity, and you were really just able to touch on it, and I know today you wanted to get in more in-depth. So can you give us a little bit of a recap about what we already discussed and go from there?
Yeah, that sounds good. You know, when I started meditating, my first teacher, Baba Hari Das, an East Indian, very, very realized soul, when I was 12 years old, I started meditating and doing yoga, and I really didn't know, I mean, what is enlightenment to a 12-year-old. And, you know, they say you're going to practice this meditation for 7 years, and you're going to get fully illuminated. And, you know, now I kind of laugh at that because I've been meditating every day for 30 years, and my definition of full enlightenment, or what Buddha calls the Tathagata, is so much deeper. And it's so much deeper because of the more experience you have meditating, and you go into states of consciousness and you figure, this has got to be it. There can't be anything better than this. And that's exactly what the Buddha warns in his Lankavatara Sutra, of masters or yogis reaching certain states of consciousness, thinking they've reached it all and this is it, you know, you can retire, you know, and yet you can't levitate a stone, you can't make a flower blossom, you can't even grow a tree in this state of consciousness. So obviously, when we think of, you know, what is, you know, God consciousness and the full extent of that, obviously, not only created the earth and the sun and the moon and the planets, and but all of the stars, and then which comprise, you know, hundreds of millions of suns are in the Milky Way galaxy. And then there's galaxies, and each one of them are bigger than universes were to the most ancient philosophers and masters. Like even in the Hindu Bhagavad Gita and the Mahabharata, a universe is not as big as what we understand now. In fact, it's nowhere near as big as what we understand now. And in the Christian Bible, the idea of a universe and a cosmos is, of course, very small, very myopic, and also in the Quran and also the ancient you know, Hebrew scriptures, we don't really know what a universe is. And then you think of, okay, the intelligence that created this, what Gary Schwartz, he's a brilliant psychiatrist and consciousness researcher at the University of Arizona at Tucson, says he calls God the guiding organizing designer, you know, of the whole universe. And they have scientifically, you know, verify that this consciousness is active. It's still creating the universe, and it's all still happening. But when we talk about a person who reaches enlightenment, we think, why can't you even levitate a rock or make something disappear? And these are just magic tricks. I mean, this has nothing to do with the experience of that consciousness. And Buddha's emphasis, you know, in the 6th century BC, was that, you know, I'm not God, he would say. I am a teacher who has found a system for the eradication of the experience of suffering. And so his whole emphasis, he's almost like a doctor. Buddha is more, he sees himself as a psychic physician. He's going to remove your perception of suffering. And when he says that, he doesn't just mean you're going to be feeling a little bit better or you're going to be blissed out, you know, nothing. It's way, way beyond that. And I'm going to go into that in a few minutes here. But one of the most important things about, you know, thinking of oneness, and when people hear the word singularity, they go, oh, that's nothing new. I mean, it's all one, or we're all just one. And what I say to them is, well, first, you know, as a deep meditator, you have to understand, you know, why you're in this body with this voice and these emotions and these thoughts, and you live in something that's not going to last more than 150 years at best if you're a super, you know, human, and which is really just a second. It's a blip on the cosmic screen in time. And so you're going to die, and as a physical organism, and you're suffering, and you're experiencing bliss, so there's pleasure and there's pain, and you only have so long to do something with your life to make a difference in the world. You really don't have that much time. And so we say, when a person attains enlightenment, we say, you know, what is this enlightenment in the West? You know, this word came in, and it's very, very popular now, and a person is enlightened because they reach a certain amount of bliss consciousness, and there's no perception of suffering anymore. They're blissed out. And then beyond the bliss, their mind goes into these different levels of cosmic consciousness. And we're so happy just to get that, because we suffer so much here. I mean, of course, not every day. It's not that bad every day. But I mean, that we do suffer here. And then we also experience love, and we experience bliss, and we experience war, and we experience disasters, and we experience personal loss and personal gain, all these things. So our ideas of enlightenment in the beginning, in the West, I believe, were quite naive and quite small and very, very myopic. So there I am, 12 years old, and my guru is telling me, you know, that he actually told one of his disciples to tell David, who's only 12 years old, that he has everything he needs to get enlightened in this lifetime. And he's almost there, like it's going to be easy for him to get enlightenment and you know, the full thing, not just the little thing. And this, you know, for me, I don't, by Buddha's definition, and you're going to see in this tour I'm going to give you, I still fall short of the definition of Buddha's enlightenment. And it's, the picture that I'm going to give you is a personal experience that happened to me after 7 years of practicing meditation every single day. And doing as much as 6 hours of sitting, holding the sitting posture every day. Planting trees. I planted over 1.3 million trees in British Columbia and done oil spill cleanup, and I spoke on Congress on nuclear fusion and fought for clean energy and worked on landmine and bomb detection. You know, I've done a lot of things that some people would say, well, you know, the good karma or the right, what you call right livelihood in Buddhism, is just what you're doing for a living should be in harmony with your spiritual path if you really want this enlightenment. So it shouldn't be any surprise what I'm about to tell people. And I think I briefly mentioned this experience on the last show, but I didn't describe it at all. And what happened is, you know, it's not an accident when you're that passionate. I wanted to know God so bad. I wanted this enlightenment. I didn't care about being a millionaire. For me, it was about, you know, you only have so much time in this life. It doesn't matter how much money I pile up by the end of my life. I don't care about that. I want the real deal. I want this consciousness that when I die it gives me full access to all the highest levels of the universe. I don't want to just be some guy that floats around in an astral body after I die. I want way better access. To me, life is about how do you gain access to the best consciousness and the best places in the universe. It's not about, you know, how much fame or how much I can attain in this physical dimension. You know, how much I can build here, how many mansions I can build. These things didn't matter to me. Fly in a spaceship when I was a little kid. I wanted to reach the stars and the cosmos. I didn't care about these things. So I wanted to know, what does it take to do that? Because whatever it takes, I'm going to do it. And if that means being poor and being a tree planter and being, you know, ridiculed in my country and treated terribly by my Canadian government, which is what happened, I'm going to do that. And because it's not, I don't care what reward I may or may not get in this world. And that is a huge commitment right there.
Can I just interrupt you for, for a second? I want to clarify because a lot of spiritual teachers, if I'm interpreting their teachings correctly, a lot of modern day North American Western spiritual teachers tell you that when you pass on, no matter what your life has been like, whether you've been a good person or a horrible person, that once you pass on, you automatically have access to all of that. And it sounds like what you're saying is your belief is that in order to really have access to those higher levels of consciousness, even after you pass on, you need to do personal work in your living present life.
Well, that statement doesn't make any sense to Buddha, to Christian mysticism, and deep, you know, Hinduism, and there's no truth to that statement at all. We just in our physical lives on this planet, there are people that have the hardest time when someone's trying to love them. They just can't let them in. Well, let's just use that as a simple definition before I go into this huge experience. And they actually reject it. People that will reject true love in their life because their symbols on what is the most important symbol to them may be financial stability and security. That's higher for them than love. And this is how the universe kind of tests us, I believe, to see where you're really at. You know, where do you want to go? I mean, what are your symbols? What's the most important thing in a relationship to you? Is it what your partner looks like? Is it how fit they are? Or actually, is it how much money they have? Or is it what their status is in civilization? Or is it their power? If you go through each of the seven chakras, you can see imagery, even iconography, and symbols attached to each one of those energy centers in the body. And the more advanced we get in our spirituality, it doesn't mean we're going to be poor. It just means that it doesn't matter if you have it or you don't have it. When you're really absorbed in consciousness, one minute you could be living in a tent, as I have done for, you know, almost a decade, and then next minute you're living in an incredibly big house with a swimming pool, which is what I'm doing now. It doesn't make any difference. You know, someone could take all this away from me right now and I'd still be meditating. I'd still be experiencing the same consciousness. The difference is there's no attachment to it. In Buddhism, non-attachment means neither clinging nor rejecting. It doesn't mean because I'm unattached, I'm going to get rid of everything and I'm not going to have anything in my life because I'm practicing non-attachment. That's not non-attachment in Buddhism. In Buddhism, non-attachment means you're so absorbed in spirit and the soul that you're not going to be super depressed if something happens on the periphery. It's not going to ruin you. It will affect you, but it's not going to ruin you at all. And that if your experience of consciousness gets incredibly deep, it won't even register as a blip on the screen of your peripheral awareness, which is the physical and material. But from my own experience of meeting people in this world, before we even get to heaven, you can clearly see where people's symbols are. And you can clearly see when people are afraid of an emotion, an overwhelming emotion of love. Saint Francis of Assisi was the first, you know, Catholic saint to receive the stigmata and suffer the crucifixion and the wounds of Christ. And his disciples would actually see him outside in the middle of the night on the top of the mountain in Assisi, and he's in this blaze of light conversing with Jesus, and then he would tell them, don't ever tell anybody what you saw. Don't ever tell anybody that you saw this, that Jesus was appearing to me. And St. Francis says, please let me experience the passion, the suffering that you went through. So Jesus gives him the stigmata, and he's suffering, and you know, it's unimaginable the pain that Jesus' body went through. And then St. Francis says, now can I experience the compassion you had for humanity? And he said it was blinding. It was so overwhelming. He said he couldn't bear it. The love that Jesus had for all of creation and humanity was unbearable. And that's the doorway. That's the beckoning and the knowing that there's something beyond that we can bear. And that sets the precedent for when we die. Do we have access to all of it? No. No, because we can't bear it. And we, each one of us, can only bear a certain amount of that consciousness. And the Buddhists, the Tibetans don't, you know, when I was in India with the Dalai Lama and meeting with some of the Tenzin, some of his teachers and Rinpoches, they said, this isn't a belief system for us. He said, you know, you Westerners come here and you're studying Buddhism and you think this is our belief system. He said, we found this is true. We traveled out of body, went in the in-between states in the after realm. And he said, this is not our belief. We've mapped the cosmos, what Professor Robert Thurman calls psychonauts, the psychological astronauts of the in-between states in the out-of-body realms. He said, so this is not our belief system. We've actually found this is true. And I there's a lot of great evidence for what the Tibetans have found on the other side that even cross religions, cross their religions. So what I'm about to show you, it first happened. This happened before my first actual meeting with Jesus Christ, practicing Buddhism. this just shows you how singular and non-dual God really is. And it was 1986, December 22nd, a couple of days before Christmas, and it was raining in Vancouver, and I started shaking. My knees were like wobbling. It felt like I was coming apart at the seams, like there was a fissure, a deep crack that went through my psyche. And I just lied down in my room. It was about 4:15 in the afternoon on that day, and I just instantly cracked in this fissure of consciousness, and I was, it's as if I went to a lucid dream instantaneously, not like I fell asleep for a while. And all of a sudden I'm seeing in the clearest vision an old man who looks like he's dead. He's lying down in a bed in the poorest house that appears to be in the middle of the plains in the American Southwest. That's where I believe I was in the spiritual dimension. And two women with long brown hair wearing white are praying over his body, and he looks like he's dead. Suddenly he gets up, and he looks at me full of life, and he says, do you want to see an angel? And the second I said the word yes, there was this thunderous white light, just blinding thunderous light. It was pulsing like thunder, and behind the pulses of thunderous sound were the voices of angels singing, and the voices were so beautiful. It makes Beethoven's, you know, ninth and seventh symphonies seem like child's play. The music, the quality of the music and the sound vibration. There was no bliss, there was no ecstasy, there was nothing but pure fear of the power and the magnitude of this source of this light and the angels' voices. I mean, just made that fissure and that crack split through me even further. It knocked me to the ground in the vision, and I fell on the ground in the vision, and I was aware of my body in my bedroom, you know, near Jericho Beach in Vancouver. And it was simultaneous awareness, and the sound was deafening. I mean, it would surely destroy any human ear. In fact, there are descriptions of Beethoven when he heard the music of the spheres, and when Pythagoras heard the music of the angels, they said it would literally what caused Beethoven to go deaf, because he could actually hear the music of God. And I was hearing these angels' voices, but there's no bliss. It's just fear and terror and thunderous sound. And piece by piece, in my bedroom, my feet became paralyzed. My knees were paralyzed. My hips locked up, and I couldn't move them. I mean, physically could not move my body. I was losing control over being in control of my faculties of mind and body. And this paralysis went up my spine, and then all of a sudden my arms dropped at my sides on the bed, and I'm seeing this as I'm physically aware. So there's nothing like a dream. And then all of a sudden it starts to strangle my neck, and I just say, you know, it's obviously God, David. I mean, don't be afraid anymore. Just relax. You don't have to be afraid of this. And because it's obvious, listen to the voices. The voices of the angels are the most beautiful thing. And when I describe this, when I say it's beautiful, let's say you're a person who didn't like classical music. It's not like that. It's not like I like this music or I don't like this music. You're not being emotionally moved by the music. You're actually, the music is shining from the truth of the light of the universe. So you're being moved by the truth of the light. It has nothing to do with the beats or, you know, do I like this kind of music or not? You know, is there classical music in heaven? Is it a big opera? So I paralyzed. I fell back. I couldn't move my neck, and then I couldn't have a thought. And this is the funny thing, because meditators say, you know, you want to meditate until you don't think, which is really kind of silly in my opinion now, but you want to stop your thoughts, and if you stop your thoughts, like you're trying to strangle the head of a snake, and you're trying to say to the snake, don't talk, and the snake is your mind, and you're strangling it and saying, don't talk, and, you know, don't have a thought, and then you'll be enlightened. It's utter nonsense. But anyway, so could not think if I tried. I went into this pure state of death. And all of a sudden, I just relaxed, and the singing got louder and louder, and it was pure white light, and the two women had fallen on the floor with me. They had lost control of their bodily functions, and there's so much light, and the angel's singing, and the man is lying there who said, you want to see an angel. And all of a sudden, all of the fear, all of the terror of God, this ripping explosion of ecstasy started in my belly, and it was so blissful. I mean, like a million times the greatest ecstasy I'd ever experienced in meditation or human love and affection. It exploded from my belly, and I flew out of my body and went above the city of Vancouver and through the clouds at amazing speed. And I came above the earth, and there was a bright light off to my left. I never saw an angel with wings, but I saw this being kind of floating with me. And the ecstasy was unbearably bright. I mean, it was far more than I ever imagined enlightenment to be, just in this first state. And this angel told me that I'm in what's called the first light, or I'm just above the earth in this first light, and I see hundreds of thousands of silvery gray oval-shaped cocoons hovering above the earth. This is 1986, December 22nd. And as I see close, I move close to the silvery gray cocoons, I'm told by this being of light that these are the souls of the departed. And you're seeing these little lights flickering inside of their silvery gray cocoons. And to them, that silvery gray cocoon, to the individual soul, that's their auric field. And the visions they're having, the dreams, the life review, going over their souls, memories, those are the movies that are flashing on the screen inside of the silvery gray cocoon. And what had happened to me, that the being told me, is yours cracked. Mine cracked open. I got out of the egg, the egg or the oval-shaped energy field of the human aura, and I'm out in the cosmos now in the first clear light realm. And I came up to some of the two eggs. And as I came close to them, they started to shake, and they were terrified, and they were having visions of fear, and they thought, oh, my God, this is evil, this is terrible, and they were afraid of me, because the light of the first heaven is so terrifying to the ego or egg of the limiting sphere of consciousness of the human that it's going to crack it open. And that process of dying, what Jesus said in the Gospel of Philip, is you must die first before you enter the kingdom of heaven. He actually says you must be destroyed in the Gospel of Philip. He goes even further than what he says in the canonized Gospels. You have to be destroyed. And that's what had happened to me. My egg was cracked open and destroyed, but I had no fear of losing control of the, you know, the human faculties, which are kind of boring in the end. And there's so much love, and there's so much ecstasy, and there's so much peace. And once the angel said to me, there's nothing you can do. You can't force them to crack open. He said, those souls are going to reincarnate. They're too afraid of this super openness of this consciousness, that they're not ready. And interesting enough, before we go further, in the near-death experience, many people describe the tunnel, silvery gray tunnel, with a little pinprick of light at the end of it. And it turns out that is their own tunnel, the walls of their own silvery gray cocoon. And the light on the other side of it is the first clear light. And the first clear light is easy enough for many people to see when they die, but from what Jesus told me in person is most, they're in it for seconds to minutes to days, and in rare cases years before they're so afraid of being that open and that full of love they can't handle it. They want to shut down and they want to go back into being an ego and they want to suffer. So they reincarnate until they wake up. Well, suddenly we started zooming through the universe going towards the center of our own galaxy at such amazing speed. The voice told me there was no being of light anymore. It was just me looking down at my hands, my arms, and my legs, which were pure light and utterly the most perfect form. And I was told there are millions of paradise planets in this first heaven. And I started traveling at such super speeds, superluminal, faster than the speed of light. And we reached this, you could see this, like, it was like a membrane. It was like the edge of a cell, you know, the kind of like translucent wall. And as I approached the end of what I was told was the first heaven, the ecstasy and the love and the peace and the cosmic consciousness began to crush that my body. I had reached the limit of what this particular form of humanism could handle. Imagine so much ecstasy that I'm begging God, please, please stop. This is far too great. And the angel singing was louder and louder, and it was, the singing never stopped. And the singing, I could hear it with my feet. I could hear it with every atom in my body. I could point my finger towards a star, and it was like a telescope. I was flying in this consciousness. And as I got to the membrane, the crushing ecstasy was so almost unbearable. It's like too much pleasure, too much ecstasy, being tickled by, you know, a million bliss balls. And you, when in the body, you're thinking, you're meditating, you're focusing on the third eye, and you're waiting for the kundalini to go up your spine, and you can't even imagine levels of ecstasy like this. As soon as I pierced the membrane, I went into the second heaven. And in the second heaven, the body of myself is a million times brighter than the first body, which was already a million times brighter than the best human experience I'd ever had. But it's not an irritating, adrenalized ecstasy. It's perfectly smooth and velvety and peaceful. The peace sustains the ecstasy so that it can be permanent. So you don't beg for a calm like you do when you have a powerful emotion and then you want to come down. It's perfect. And it's a million times the first. And the body in the second heaven can handle the ecstasy increase, which is a millionfold, because it's a more perfect vehicle for that consciousness. And I zoomed through that part of the galaxy at a tremendous speed, and I was told there are also millions of paradise planets in this heaven. And these are not pleasure heavens. I mean, for those who understand the difference between the clear light heavens and the pleasure heavens, these are the clear light heavens. These are the samadhic realms. Paramahansa Yogananda describes, you know, Hiranyaloka and all these sacred planets for very, very evolved souls. They're real planets, but they're not astral. They're not planets of physical pleasure. The pleasures in this bliss makes all human physical pleasures completely obsolete. And then I went into the third, and when I went to the third, it multiplies another million times, and I could hear the third was the end. There's so, billions and billions of folds of ecstasy and love and peace in the third. There are qualities in the consciousness that you cannot name. The physical form I contained there was so bright you could barely see the arms and the legs. I was looking down at myself as I was flying through, just like right now you can look at your hands and your feet. And I had begged God, please stop, as I was racing towards the membrane for the fourth. I said, oh my God, I was doubting all gurus, all enlightened teachers, just in the third. Emanuel Swedenborg, the great Swedish Christian mystic who attained up to the third heaven, and he swore there was, could not possibly be anything beyond the third. He said, this is the most supreme enlightenment. And in a way, he's right, because what happens next is, it's the final place. And there are millions of paradise planets in the third. It's the final place for the human form as a emanation, as an appearance. The consciousness beyond the third is so vast that it cannot even appear inside of a container is an astral luminary body that looks like a human form. It's too bright, it's too powerful, and most of the awareness is in the expansive field of the universe. There's no perception of the limitation of the boundary of self. The self, you know, for most humans ends at the skin, and then for some humans it goes to the emotional, and other humans it goes more into the expansive field of consciousness, and then there are other humans that can go into these states in the body. But I doubted all gurus at this point, because I said, there's no, you're in so much ecstasy, so much love, there's no way you could move your pinky, because you wouldn't know where it is, because you're the mountain, you're the tree, you're the sky, you're the wall, you're the stone. There is no separation. It's pure non-duality, even in the third. In fact, it feels that way even in the first. It's just there are greater degrees of this oneness, of this singularity. And I went through the fourth, and the ecstasy multiplies another million times. So it's kind of like earthquakes, you know. An 8-point earthquake is 10 times stronger than a 7. It's not twice as strong, it's 10 times. But this is a million, literally a million times. And as I was zooming through the fourth, there was no more form of human that is purely spherical light that I was, that was probably light years across in size. The volume is size as I was zooming through the fourth. Your consciousness is purely engrossed in stars and planetary bodies and fields of light. You don't have anything that resembles humanness at this point. And so why go further? I mean, it just seems like, you know, as a human being, there's this light is like 10 quadrillion billion candlelight power of luminosity. There doesn't seem to be any point in being more enlightened than this. And I literally begged God. I said, you have to stop. Don't. I was speeding at incredible speeds going towards the fifth. I could see the membrane to the fifth part of the galaxy in the universe. And I said, no, stop. And it just kept taking me. And I pierced the fifth, and the fifth is the beginning. It's utterly unspeakable. It's unimaginable that every one of us has this potential inside of us to reach these levels of consciousness that many masters have passed through, and we're sitting there living our lives in the city, and we're worried about finances and jobs and paying our mortgage and our rent, and this is going on every day, all the time in the universe. And there are people that live in these states of consciousness all the time. And we're thinking, oh, my God, I'm worried about these trivial little things. I haven't really got it yet. And when I went to the sixth, it was, there are qualities in the fifth and the sixth. I call them the graces. There are numerous graces. They're very feminine in nature, but not like the femininity in our world. It really feels like you're in the divine mother's presence, the mother of the cosmos. It has no resemblance of the human feminism. But the graces are so astounding that each one of them makes ecstasy and love completely obsolete. Ecstasy and love have no purpose, no meaning anymore. You're perceiving them in the fifth. In the sixth, they're fully evident. There's no ecstasy seems like a dim-lit bulb at this point, because you're talking about millions of fold exponential increase. And I thought at this point, there's no way I can be human anymore. There's no way I can go back there, back to my room. My consciousness is the size of the galaxy, and I'm near the center of the galaxy now, and the angel singing is utterly deafening. I can see that their voices are causing the stars and the planets to be born and maintaining their orbits. I can see that the voices are not just singing like God's choir, we're singing to praise the Lord. They're actually singing creation. The sounds are giving birth to the spin of subatomic particles, stars to planets, to the spin of the galaxy itself, and they're way beyond the physicality of that. And then I entered the sixth, I was in the sixth, and I got to the edge of the seventh, and something told me, if you cross this seventh, you will never come back. It's over. And all of a sudden, I saw the membrane of the seventh. I was inside of the membrane, and I just stopped. I said, I have to. What stopped me from going? Hello?
Hello?
Are we still there?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, I just heard a sound saying you are now in the host queue. Anyway, so I'm in the membrane of the seventh, and what stopped me was my desire to tell others. And my desire to tell others that don't think for a minute that this business of getting enlightened is something small, and don't think for a minute that you're going to sit there and oscillate between, you know, there's going to be more fun in hell because there's parties and there's food and there's women and all these and men and all these things. Don't think for a minute that it's one or the other. This utterly annihilates, even the first heaven annihilates all of your possibilities of ever being bored. They're, the ideas of entertainment and movies and music that humans experience all become obsolete in the first heaven. This is so worth it to do whatever it takes to do this meditation and to live the meditation, to actually embody it, to do something for a living that's going to make a difference. Because this is, it turns out, as we'll find out, this is everybody's potential. And so I came out of the experience, my physical spine was buzzing like an electric cord, and I'm lying in my bed, and there was not even a billionth of that ecstasy left. There wasn't, it was all turned off. It was like suddenly someone turned out the brightest lamp in the universe. I couldn't hear the music, it was all gone. I was so depressed, I couldn't believe that God had put me up there. And just because I had the desire to come back and tell others that it was all turned out. Well, the next day at 4:15 in the afternoon, it happened again. And it started at 4:15. I didn't have to suffer the cracking of the egg again. I just went straight into the heavens. I went all the way. I was shown my last life. I was born in 1961. I was a small Tibetan baby when the Chinese invaded Tibet and they killed the millions of Tibetans. 2 million Tibetans to date or more have been killed by the Chinese invasion. I was just one of those little Tibetan babies, and I saw my death. I saw myself floating above the temple in the Himalayas, and I went into the light. So, no big deal. I mean, dying is very easy once you're on the other side of the skin. So there I was. I went all through all of them again, and I came to the seventh again, and I didn't cross. I said, no, I'm going to devote my life to telling people that this is their potential. Because what started me on this meditation path is when I read the descriptions of meditation masters from India when they describe the states of consciousness. That was my motivation to meditate. So I wanted to tell people this experience so that they would meditate, and they would meditate correctly, and they would learn the states of consciousness themselves. So eventually, many years passed, because this is 1986, I was looking for the answer to where I was. I went to near-death experience meetings where I had met other people that had been in the first couple of the Clear Light Heavens. I still didn't really have my answer, and I went to India, and I was in Dharamsala where the Buddha was enlightened, where he attained his enlightenment, and I met with a young Rinpoche, and which are really, Rinpoches are kind of students of Rinpoche, Guru Rinpoche, which is the father of Tibetan Buddhism, and his female consort, Yishi Shogyal, and they are kind of Tibetan authorized teachers who have reached a certain level of consciousness. And he couldn't tell me where I was. He said he'd never heard of an experience like that. And I really felt this young Rinpoche's vibration. He had an amazing vibe when I left, and I thought he didn't know where I was. And I picked up this book called the Lankavatara Sutra by the Buddha, and he describes that over 400 lifetimes, the Buddha perfected the first 6 of the clear light samadhis, which I had been through in the preceding, you know, years ago, because this is now years later. This is 1996 when I was in India. And he said, many yogis attain up to the sixth samadhi, being deluded, thinking they've attained full enlightenment. And some of these yogis, when they die, they live in these super high luminary realms for millions of years even. And Buddha will suddenly come, you know, after they've been steeped in this bliss for literally aeons. And when he shows himself, they go, oh my God, I'm nowhere near enlightened yet. I'm long ways away from it. You know, depending on which of the samadhis they were in. Buddha tells us in the Lankavatara Sutra that the samadhis, 1 through 6, are impermanent states of consciousness, which explains why I was in it and then I was out of it. I was right back to physical suffering again. Because they're really just practice. Can you believe that? Practice for nirvana. And nirvana begins at the seventh, which explains the seventh veil that I did not want to cross. And Buddha says, once you cross and you become a seventh level master, which many of Buddha's disciples, including his own wife, Yasodhara, attains. She attains nirvana, which is the seventh. And Buddha then says that if you take the vow to become a bodhisattva and not cross into the seventh as extinction, this is very specific so people can understand what a bodhisattva really is. Nirvana actually means you go into extinction in God consciousness. There is no more you anymore at all, which means there's no more you as an isolated ego in the first heaven, but there's no more you for real when you go into seventh, because you literally merge and experience what God is experiencing all day, which is the whole universe and the highest levels of consciousness in the universe. There's no point. There's no astral projection form anymore. He said, unless you take this vow to be a bodhisattva and keep an emanation body for the appearance of students only, you will eventually attain the eighth and the ninth, which is unimaginable. Simply unimaginable to me from my perspective, because each one of these that you go through, it's going to multiply at least a million times. And then you're going to be permanently lit in that state. Buddha says once you take the vow to cross the seventh, you're only useful to humans for the rest of that life because you're too powerful to reincarnate again. Your body, the physicality of it could not handle the magnitude of consciousness of a person who goes beyond that point. Now,
David,
when you read, yeah.
Can I stop you there? So you're saying that theoretically if you were meditating and, like, for you personally, if you had gone into that seventh state, would your physical body have just disappeared?
Well, here's what I thought was going to happen. And again, there's no thinking there. I mean, the idea of thinking or not thinking, it's pure vibrational, massive movements of consciousness at that point. It's not like a human thought. But the field told me that I would physically become the whole thing, not just my consciousness. And that's why the more you study this enlightenment, seventh level masters and on can do unimaginable things, things that are pure science fiction to us today. You know, like Jesus, yeah.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to ask about Jesus. So in your opinion, because you said that once someone reaches the seventh level, they can't be reincarnated. So was Jesus Christ, he was born here on the physical planet, was he not a seventh level?
Oh, my God, no, way beyond the seventh. And Jesus is a whole other thing. It's unimaginable who that being is. There's no way a human can fathom. What we saw in the four canonized Gospels is the kindergarten version of who Jesus really is. When we read the Gnostic Gospels, we get a clearer picture, especially if you read the Gospel of Judas. You'll really start to get a picture. Here's an example. Dante Alighieri. And Dante, until I read Dante, I had no idea that in Christian mysticism there was anybody who would attain the ninth. And in Buddhism, the eighth and the ninth are unspeakable. In the Gnostic Gospels, you can search on Google the treatise of the eighth and the ninth. And like I said, in Buddhism, only the bodhisattvas eventually reach the eighth and the ninth. The ones that go into extinction remain at the seventh level of God. But Dante, in the Divine Comedy, once he purges himself through hell and purgatory and he's cleansed himself of all the lower human nature, he ascends the same, and his descriptions, when you read the Paradiso, are the most beautiful descriptions. Like what I just described now is, it's nothing compared to the way Dante describes the experience of going through the seven spheres of consciousness. But Dante goes to the eighth and the ninth, and his descriptions convince me, having been there myself, that he wasn't writing a fictitious fantasy of what it might be like to go through the nine spheres of consciousness. He was really there. And what I love about his story is it's a romantic story. He's not this celibate monk who goes there by himself. You know, he's in love with Beatrice, this angel, this super, super enlightened mystic who died of an influenza at like 12 years old, and because her mission in life was simply to take Dante on the same journey and show him how advanced the heavens of consciousness really are. And when Dante, because this is going to answer your question about who was Jesus, he finally reaches the ninth, and I can't even imagine the ninth. The ninth is a million times, a million times, a million times where I left off at the sixth, and I saw the edge of the seventh, but I didn't pierce the seventh. And Dante's there, and just to be inside of the consciousness of the ninth on its own is a miracle. And he's there, and he goes to this imperium, this rose petal flowered stadium, and all of these Catholic saints like Saint Bernard of Clairvaux and Saint Teresa of Avila, they're all there. And their meditation is to try to gaze directly upon the eyes of the Virgin Mary, because she's so powerful in the ninth sphere of consciousness that you think, you know, you don't ever think for a minute this is boring. When you're looking into the eyes of the Virgin Mary, you're the whole universe. Where do you want to travel? You're the whole thing. And that's their meditation. And after they practice looking at her, Saint Bernard of Clairvaux takes Dante by the hand, and he said, "Now it's your turn to try to gaze upon Jesus Christ, just to try." He said, "No one can do it," and he takes him by the hand, and Dante lets go, and he looks up, and he sees Jesus, and the levels of superconsciousness are so massive that Jesus just transfigures into this rainbow of cosmic light. And forget all the, because all the lights beneath the ninth are already beyond, you know, most of humanity's abilities at this point in time. So just to be there, and Jesus turns into this super cosmic explosion of consciousness, and he has no form anymore, and he tells Dante, there are nine more levels of consciousness above this point. No angel, no soul, no one has ever been there. And it's not that God rejects them, they just can't bear it. So they're virgin, meaning they're, no one has ever trespassed there, they're virgin territory. They're for the taking for the first angel or the first human who dares to try, but they just can't. But they're there. So this is how God evolves. As our magnification of the glory of God reflects into heaven, heaven, God itself, creates another heaven above it. Another superconsciousness above that one. So you never finish evolving. You can never reach the entire vision of consciousness because he's beyond all of the levels. He was born that way. He always was that. That's what he showed me. And that's why when I first saw him, he showed me no one has ever seen me in my entirety. It's utterly impossible. And what I was seeing was brighter than a thousand of our suns, and I couldn't look. I looked for a second, and I fell. Oh, my God. All of the heavens I went through, the sixth to the edge of the seventh, were easy compared to even trying to look at his face. That's how powerful the magnitude of the enlightenment of Jesus. So there's no human that could answer that question, you know, ultimately, who is he? Is Jesus the whole universe? Is he beyond the whole universe? Is he multiverses? We don't, the total body of who that being is. Now the Buddhas, the Bodhisattvas, are so powerful in themselves in Buddhism, they create entire paradise realms, Buddha lands, pure lands, for their students to rest in in the in-between realm. So it's kind of like, and this, Jesus actually told me this in my meetings with him in 1994, that in the, when you reach these higher levels of consciousness, you become a creator sun yourself. You create your own galaxies and planets and stars depending on your level of enlightenment, which is the same as the Buddhist saying, you know, we create pure lands, places for refuge, for people to live in and breathe in and exist in. So that's where our, that we're like these little cocoons right now that are in these flesh little, you know, rubbery things, and our consciousness is eventually going to supernova. It's going to suddenly explode beyond this egg, and we're going to be born for the first time, and we're going to become super creator sons. And our ability to create will probably start on a very small natural level and go, you know, trees and flowers and things like that, and eventually you reach a planetary level of creation. And so that's who's doing all the creating out there. That's why the universe is still expanding, and there are multiverses, so there's different dimensions of the universe that are still expanding, and it just keeps growing. God is evolving as much as we are. We can never get bored. The end of suffering, the end of the experience of pain and limitation, ends when we go into the higher states of consciousness. It eradicates all perception of boredom and suffering.
So, David, when you say that when beings reach these higher levels, they become creators, it almost sounds like, have you read that book, The Neverending Story?
No, but I've seen the movie. Is that the same thing?
It's a big, much more in-depth, but it's Fantasia is basically the dream world of humans, but it's another reality, and it's real. It kind of sounds similar to that level of creation where all you have to do is have a thought, and it becomes.
Well, you know, in our last conversation, I was discussing William Tiller, the PhD from Stanford University, who appears in my film Quantum Communication, and he mathematically proves that consciousness begins beyond the gamma ray spectrum, and that gamma rays, a 10-second gamma ray burst, has more energy than our sun will produce in its, you know, 4 or 5 billion years, and consciousness is more powerful than that. So when I asked him, you know, can this consciousness create planets, he laughed at me and he said, are you kidding? It can create stars and galaxies and universes. So here's a guy who was, you know, physicist and scientist for 40 years, and all the scientific experiments he's done with the power of the mind and consciousness, he's convinced that the consciousness force, which should be adopted as a true force in the world of physics, he believes, and many others believe, what is known as subtle energy. It's just like there are four major forces in nuclear science. There's a strong force, which is what's holding and binding the atoms together and preventing them from flying apart. There's electromagnetism or magnetism, and there's the weak force, and then there's gravity. So those are the four physical forces, but what Tiller believes and many others believe, like, you know, many, many physicists believe, and Max Planck, the godfather of quantum physics, believes, is consciousness is a force. And it is the creative force. It's the thing that's creating this whole thing. And when you see that physicists have discovered this, and you go, you know, and you hear the story that I just told you. This is just one person's story. There have been thousands to hundreds of thousands of people that have lived on this earth that have attained the 7th, the 8th, and the 9th. And I've only seen up to the 6th. You know, and as a Westerner from, you know, Canada and the United States, that might seem like a science fiction story I'm telling you, but anybody I know who has applied themselves to daily meditation for 30 years or more, they have experiences like this. So that's why I do this. Why do I want to tell this story to the world? Not to say, oh, you know, I'm so great, I went up to this great heaven. I'm saying that please, like, you know, turn your back on drugs. They will never lead you to these places. It is so worth it to go inside of every one of our major religions in the world are techniques that can teach us how to get into these states of consciousness. if they're not in your religion, then you need to, if you really want to have the real experience of God and not just have it a belief system, then you need to find a practice that works for you. Because if you do this, this will happen.
So, David, we have a question in the chat room from My Chi Heart. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. And this person wants to know, is this meditation available somewhere that takes you to that point? So you experienced that through years and years of meditation, correct?
Well, I practiced meditation for many years, and I put meditation lessons. There are many different meditation lessons on my website at voiceentertainment.net. I have them as CDs and MP3 downloads. And I've really stripped out a lot of the foreign language, which is not necessary. And there are some very severe misinterpretations of Eastern teachings that can really lead you astray, that are not going to help you reach the state of consciousness I'm talking about. And these are what I call the pitfalls of the meditation or spiritual path. And one of the biggest pitfalls is ideas on non-attachment. And what the idea that there's a God that is measuring your actions, and it's what lets you into this consciousness or rejects you. There's no parental figure that says, yes, you can come in, or no, you can't, because I like what you did or I don't like what you did, and you got it right and you got it wrong. It doesn't work like that at all. So all those ideas that, you know, holier than thou, or you have to recite this mantra so perfectly, or if you do something that this person disagrees with, oh, you're never going to get to heaven. Just erase all those ideas. Non-attachment is probably the most harmful idea that's come out of India. The human romantic love that we can potentially experience in the West, in fact, Dante is my favorite. He's my favorite mystic of all time because he was human and he attained God consciousness. You know, Jesus may be the greatest master I've ever seen, but he wasn't born in the suffering consciousness. He always was God consciousness. He never was not. Jesus just took form. And what I love about Dante is he's in love with a girl, and he uses that love, that human romantic love, and it vibrates so purely it eventually takes him into the journey of his own heart, his own purity, which leads him to God consciousness. And this whole idea that you're going to be a celibate and you're not going to be in love, even Emanuel Swedenborg, who attains the third heaven, if you read Swedenborg's Heaven and Hell, he tells you that the celibates remain in the lowest part of heaven. They remain in the outer or first realm. Now, don't think that means that if you're celibate that you're going to end up there. That doesn't mean that at all. He's saying that the nature of God consciousness is it's not about aloofness and isolation. It's all about perfect relationship and perfect love for everything. So even though human love is idle and it's feeble and it's full of errors and thorns, it's still the beginning. And I believe I left my life as a Tibetan monk in my previous lives because in those cultures, couples are kind of joined by their parents, joined by society. They don't have the freedom to choose who they're going to fall in love with or not fall in love with. And it's ironic that Jesus, most likely, was married to Mary Magdalene, and she was never a prostitute, and she is clearly the most advanced of all the disciples. She's the first one to see him after the resurrection. And in the Gnostic literature, Jesus delivers her the highest of all the teachings, and all the men are jealous. Clearly, she was a supermaster. Buddha was married to Yasodhara, and he had a child, Rahula, and they were deeply in love. And when Buddha came back from the forest, and he attained the full, the seventh, and Buddha was going from the 7th, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. He was putting it in this teaching, this language, which is the core of the Buddhist philosophy and teaching, to teach others to get enlightenment. He didn't want to just bliss out in nirvana and just forget everybody. He wanted to go down each state of consciousness back into suffering. He had full control over it and put it in a language so that others could follow this path and attain nirvana. When he comes back, from the forest, the first thing he does, and he's in the highest consciousness, and he wants to see his wife. He asks his father, where is she? You know, where's my wife? Yasodhara. And Yasodhara had, it almost gives me tears just thinking of the Buddha's wife. She shaved her head. She got rid of all of her jewelry. She had been meditating while she was raising their son in the palace. She wanted the same enlightenment as him. And he looked at her. They hadn't seen each other in years. And she said to him, did you really have to leave me to attain this? And she falls on his at his feet, and she's crying and wiping his feet with her tears, just as Mary Magdalene did with Jesus. There's so much love in this relationship. And she follows the Buddha's teachings, and she attains enlightenment, full enlightenment. I mean, I have the deepest respect for this seventh level. It's unimaginable what happens at that level of consciousness. She attains this, and she's the first order of the female teachings of Buddhism, the beginning of the Theras and the, you know, the Kuan Yins. And she is the first one, and she did it, and then others did it, and then other women were doing it, other men were doing it, attaining the full seventh. And I don't believe there's a seventh level master on the planet right now. And I'm sure if there were one and I met them, I would know, having been in the states of consciousness that Jesus has shown me. Once there is a full level master on the planet, a full Tathagata, if others are decent meditators, it's way easier to get the nirvana with a teacher on the planet than if there isn't one. So when one shows up, and if they're really in the seventh level, you will know. I mean, there are things the Buddha did that are, like I said, it would seem like a science fiction movie to most people. Out of his third eye, he literally manifests this, all of these invisible universes that all of his students can see. They can actually see them. It's like a movie projector. He's teaching them, you know, here's this universe, here's that universe, here's this paradise realm, here's this hell realm where people go because they want to suffer and they want to fight. And then he makes them all shrink up and go back into his third eye. This is a story from Robert Thurman. And when you're in that state of consciousness, you don't doubt these things. Walking on water, walking through walls, Jesus' disciples would lean up against him when they fell asleep and fall right through him because his body became immaterial right in front of them. These are things that masters of that level can do. And that's just child's play for them. They're actually able to create galaxies, universes in that state of consciousness. So, you know, people say to me, and I haven't been in at the edge of the seventh since that experience, but I can go in the first or the second on my own since that experience happened. But I'm very clear what Buddha says. This is the final secret. You can meditate all you want and go into the samadhis. And you do have to master 1 through 6. Buddha did it himself. But he said, in order to get from the 6th to the 7th, this is impossible. Buddha says, you have to come out of your bliss, out of your super samadhi, which you think is enlightenment at that time, and you have to do something for others. You have to seek enlightenment for humanity, for others, not for yourself. You have to do something to help the world. It doesn't mean you have to become a Buddhist teacher or a Christian teacher or a Muslim teacher. It doesn't mean these things. You have to do something. It may mean you're going to be a poet like Dante, or you're going to be a musician. I don't know what it's going to be, but it's going to be something that's going to change consciousness on the planet. And then you may get the grace, if you keep meditating, to enter the seventh and beyond. So Buddha said there's no other way to do it. You can meditate in the cave all you want. You'll never get past the sixth until you do this. Totally. This is very consistent in the Hindu Bhagavad Gita, where there's different levels of devotion, where the student is devoted to Krishna first, just in a very simple way, and then eventually you're serving the community and you're serving the world, and then eventually you get to the highest level of yoga and devotional yoga for the Krishna devotees is to serve Krishna personally. But to serve Krishna personally, you have to be in super, super, super high state of consciousness just to even perceive a being like Krishna. And again, Krishna is with Radha, and there's always a feminine counterpart in the supermasters. There always is. There always is this, the highest level of romantic love reaches God consciousness. In fact, even Emanuel Swedenborg says in the highest heavens, your twin flame and you will merge into one angel. You won't even be a separate being anymore in the highest spheres of consciousness. So this is the second deadly misnomer about enlightenment in the West, is when teachers come from India who have only attained samadhis. They're not in the highest enlightenment. I've met all of them. And they're telling us we have to be celibate, and you have to save your seed, and you can't have relationships. And you hear all these horrible stories, and I'm not going to start naming some of these stories, but where the master starts abusing the women in the organization, and it turns out they're not in the highest samadhis, and they're telling us to do the impossible. So forget those ideas. I was celibate for 8 years before I met my wife, and I can go into the same consciousness now that I could then. So it has nothing to do with liquids and chemistry in the body. This consciousness is way beyond chemistry. So don't think that chemistry in your body has anything to do with it. It has to do with how deeply you can perceive love, how deeply you can pierce this love. And there's no way when every person dies, suddenly, it's all there for them. No, they have to attain it.
So, David, we have a caller on the line. Are you interested in taking a call at this point?
Oh, sure.
Okay, so calling from, looks like possibly Skype, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hey, great show. How you doing, David?
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. Wanted to ask you a quick question. Recently, we've had a lot of advances in astronomy, and we discovered recently, solidified the fact that around every star we see planets and solar systems, and probably Earth-like planets are pretty common. So how do you perceive this new discovery? How can we factor this into our consciousness, the fact that there are many, many planets, and probably it's probably teeming with other life out there in the universe? How can we factor that into our consciousness?
Well, this is one of my favorite subjects, and you know, the idea that we only see us when we look through telescopes, we can't see any life on any other planets, and we measure the temperature of the distance between that star and that newfound planetary body, and we say, oh, that's too hot or that's too cold for humans, so there couldn't be any life there. You have to go into some biology here to understand how beings can exist at different temperatures. And around every human cell is a membrane. It's the brain of the cell. It's almost like the membranes that I went through in the seven heavens. These membranes determine how much heat to let into the cell. And they also, by their nature of their magnetic polarity matrices, determine at what speed they're going to perceive the speed of light. This is a theory that I've come up with and looking at resistance. When we measure everything in the speed of light time, so we look at light and we say, well, it's traveling at this speed, but in a vacuum, Einstein says it's traveling instantaneously.
Exactly. I was just about to say the speed of thought, yes, faster than light, yes.
Right. And thought, William Tiller measures, travels at different speeds of well. The highest consciousness singularity is truly instantaneous over any distance.
Yes.
But the first couple of chakras seem to travel at the speed of light, and the heart chakra seems to go, according to Tiller's model, at the speed of light squared. Speed of light squared, and the crown chakra is the speed of light cubed. So it's incredibly fast. I mean, when you get to the crown chakra in Tiller's model, a thought travels from here to the Pleiades 440 light years away in about a quarter of a second. I did all the math on that. So when we reach higher levels of psyche and consciousness, we're able to telepath at huge distances in a fraction amount of time. Now, what I believe causes us to see the speed of light has to do with the positive and negative charge in our polarity field is pushing against light. The same way if a boat tries to move through water, the propeller has to go faster because the boat's pushing on it, slowing it down. And the same way when we try to move an aircraft through air mass, you can go much faster through air mass than water, but the air mass pushes on you and it gives you drag and the airplane slows down. Space is also thick. It's not thin. It's not a true vacuum. So it pushes against the light itself. This is the most interesting thing in the quantum universe. All matter is dual nature. You know, you have an electron, positron. proton, antiproton, tau, antitau, muon, antimuon, a neutrino, antineutrino. You have all in the quark, up quark, and down quarks. All the particles that we're made of are dual paired. It's the duality that prevents it from even attaining the speed of light. Light itself, electromagnetism, has no counterpartner in it. It spins clockwise. It's positive. Light is a positive energy, but a positive always is attracted to a negative. And whenever you have a duality, you're going to have resistance. Because the negative background of Einstein's cosmological constant, which is the background pressure of the space fabric, is
yes.
negative, and it's attracted to the positive and white, and they push against each other, and they slow down. Well, I figured out it's not space that's doing that. It's the observer's membrane. It's the oscillation rate of the atoms in our body and our brain's consciousness. Because why, for example, can a deep meditator see a deceased person perfectly clearly, which I've done many, many times. I can see the dead as clear as I can see a living person. But a person standing next to me doesn't see it. I think it's the same way when you look at an extraterrestrial planet. You look at it from the perspective of the speed of light that we see because our matrix and our polarity field is slowing light down to the speed that we see it at, and that prevents us from seeing anything outside of that spectrum, what we call the electromagnetic spectrum. So we say, oh, there's nobody on that planet, there's nobody on that planet. But yet Dante, Emanuel Swedenborg, and Pythagoras all testify that all of our planets in our solar system have beings that are made of light vibrations, and they're doing unimaginable things even on the sun. We just don't see them. So we're alone in the universe. We can't, with these, you know, optical telescopes, we can't see how, because this is the next question, how can this organism survive the temperature on that planet? Well, it's too hot. It's too cold. It's not just right. Well, if your polarity field is different, what is temperature? Temperature is when electromagnetism pushes against the resistance of the field of the body, and it either causes heating or cooling depending on how much electromagnetism is there. Well, what if the membrane of that system, that biological system, has a different set of instructions and it lets in more light, which means in theoretically a colder environment, it can be warm. Or theoretically in a really hot environment, its resistance is set up much higher so that it's actually the resistance would be lower. Resistance causes heat. So the more resistance you have in a biological system, when electromagnetism moves against a higher resistance body, it's going to heat up more. When it's a lower resistance field, it's not going to heat up as much. So I think the membrane on some of these super beings, their membranes are so powerful and their bodies are so luminous, we don't see them, but there really is a biological structure there. So,
Well, absolutely brilliant. Hey, real quick, is there a way to connect with you on Facebook or Twitter or anything like that?
Well, on Facebook, you know, David Sarita, and I check my messages, and you can email me at davidsarita@hotmail.com.
Oh, okay, I'll send you a friend request, and I'll hang up and listen to the rest of the show.
All right, thanks for calling in.
All right, guys, thank you very much.
Thank you. So,
you know, when I talk about this experience, I'm not trying in any way to speak of it in a greatness for myself. What motivates me is I want other people to meditate because this is all of our potential. What I'm describing, there's thousands to millions of people before me that have attained way greater states than I am. I'm showing this because I'm saying, hey, this is real. Don't ignore the meditation practices in your religion, because if you really do it faithfully and properly, every one of us has this potential. We're all eventually going to pop and become super cosmic. Not only the bliss and the ecstasy is important, but the gnosis, the knowledge. Our brains evolve and our technology evolves as our cosmic consciousness evolves. The reason we're still stuck at rockets and telescopes that make us feel we're the only ones in the universe is we just haven't evolved in our thinking to develop the technology to allow us to move freely about the universe. So So my motivation is to not only expand consciousness for the eradication of suffering, which is the Buddhist perspective, but to expand our consciousness so that we can evolve as a civilization and become a interstellar civilization.
So, David, that seems like a perfect segue for what we didn't have time for the last time you were on the show. And if you – actually, I should probably tell everyone, if you are listening and you're not a member of Blog Talk Radio but you want to get in on the chat, just sign up to be a member of Blog Talk Radio. It's free, and then you'll be able to come into the chat room and join in the discussion that's happening behind the scenes. The number to call in if you want to get on the air is 1-347-202-0129. I don't know if we'll be able to get to everyone's call, but that is the number if you want to call in. And if you would like to get in touch with David, again, he's David Sarita on Facebook. You can look him up. And you can also find him at voiceentertainment.net. And also, if you're interested, from the previous show that we did in his quantum crystal jewelry, that's lightstreamtechnologies.com. So, David, I was really wanting to talk about your theory on gamma rays and the situation at Roswell, because that, when I heard that on Coast to Coast AM, it just blew my mind.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, this is where we're, as human beings, we have very deep in the mysticism of the ancient Greeks, the Sumerians, the Babylonians, the Egyptians, and many of the ancient religions in South America, we have evidence of star beings, masters of certain levels of consciousness that developed technology that allowed them to go interstellar. You know, I think in the time of the Buddha, and even in the time of Christ, there's so much physical suffering in the world, and there's so much emotional suffering, and there's so much oppression in our government, which we have today, you know, as much as any time in history, that the emphasis of enlightenment was just to get into these fields beyond the body so that we can bliss out and not notice any of this horrible treatment that our governmental bodies gave us. So the idea that many of us don't have to suffer physically as much as humans used to, and many of us don't have to suffer emotionally as much, you know, the race and the goal to attain the highest levels of enlightenment, I mean, this, it took Buddha 400 lifetimes of meditating all the time just to get the six samadhis. And then when he was the Buddha, he reaches the nirvana. It's a long journey. So it's not like we're going to meditate for 7 years and then we're just going to wake up in this fully realized state and have powers of teleportation. We need technology. And we need to evolve as a civilization. And when Buddha says, you're not going to get the seventh level until you come out of this bliss and do something for the world, I think we're, with the Hubble telescope, how much that telescope and other telescopes like NASA Spitzer and the Chandra X-ray telescope are giving us a way greater sense of where we are in the universe. It seems that as the universe gets bigger, our planet's position and it gets smaller. And we can't even go to Mars with our existing technology, so we're told. And, you know, Roswell, of course, I saw a flying saucer in Berkeley in 1968. They were Pleiadian. They communicated with me and were teaching me about the propulsion systems for the craft, which I've always wanted to build. But in this world, there's this thing called money that rules virtually everything in technology development. I mean, it's almost impossible to build something without money, or at least to have a warehouse and workers and you know, access to steel plants and metal plants and to manufacture parts and things that you need to build your you know, whatever you're building. If that can be done without money, great. I mean, for those people who don't believe in it, but this world, it seems to be ruled by it. And there just isn't that much passion, I believe, in the investment community today to really go beyond our current space technology. President Obama retired the space shuttle program here, and he's calling for an improvement in technology to get us to the space station to Mars and beyond. In fact, he canceled the Clementine, our return missions to the Moon and Mars, which I think is a really bad mistake. But yet he seems to be saying that he wants to see better technology to get us there. And I don't know if he means, does he know about the reverse engineered UFO technology from Roswell, or is he just, you know, trying to manage a budget and saying that there's a limited amount of money, even though there isn't. It's just an idea that we believe in. There's an infinite amount of labor, there's an infinite amount of knowledge, there's an infinite amount of wisdom in America, and so therefore we can do whatever we want. But we believe in bankers and they control everything, so this is where we're really stifled. Now, going back to, you know, when I saw this UFO in 1968, it was metallic, it was real, it didn't make a sound, it was hovering there. People were going crazy over it. This is 1968. The Lawrence Berkeley National Lab up on the hill had a bird's eye view of it. 2 years ago at the UFO Congress in Laughlin, Nevada, a scientist met me in the elevator and he said, I work at the space lab in the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab up on that hill, which is one of our top defense and aerospace labs. And he said to me, we all saw a flying saucer outside the window in 1972, which is only a few years after mine. So I said, we know they're real, and that's why he was here at the conference. And I meet people at these UFO conferences that I lecture from NASA, program managers from NASA, and, you know, even top defense labs around the country, like Los Alamos, Santa Fe. I've actually given private meetings to program managers at Los Alamos because they want to know about the UFO stuff that I work on. So it's not like it's just a bunch of wackos who believe in flying saucers. Believe me, the highest people in science and technology and the highest people in government want to know. So Roswell, I mean, doesn't even register in my consciousness as a child. I think Star Trek resonated in my consciousness and My Favorite Martian did, but not Roswell. And it wasn't until 1972 when our family, we moved back from California to Vancouver, Canada. My mother divorced and moved us back with our real father, when Sarita in Vancouver, and it's 1972. And I see on a Canadian TV station this Palladian contact with Billy Meyer, the Swiss farmer, and there's these photographs of flying saucers from the Pleiades that he took, and it's on the TV, and I went, that was the day that I went, oh, my God, that's what I saw in 1968 when I was 7 years old. And I said, this is really real. There's other people who saw spaceships. I'm not the only one. And I got more and more into it, and eventually I discovered Roswell. And of course, you know, for those of you who don't know, and I'm sure most have heard the story that, you know, allegedly a flying saucer crashed at Roswell, New Mexico, approximately July 7th to the 8th or 9th, 1947, and another flying saucer crashed near the Trinity site where the first atomic bomb was tested, July 22nd, 1945. There was another crash at Socorro, New Mexico, and there were actually about three or four crash sites. There wasn't just one flying saucer at Roswell. And initially, the paper said that a flying saucer crashed and the Army had retrieved alien bodies. Next thing you know, the newspaper said it was a weather balloon and there was a whole cover-up, and everybody knew it was a lie. And the cover-up is so strong that even presidents cannot get answers. And when I say presidents, I mean many presidents, from John F. Kennedy to Bobby Kennedy, who have made inquiries into UFOs, to Truman, to even Gerald Ford, and to Bill Clinton, and Hillary Clinton. And I don't know if George Bush has ever testified anything, but there's a website called presidentialufo.com or .org, and you can find out information there. So even they can't get answers. So somebody knows. And I decided, you know, from years working with top quantum physicists and working for nuclear engineers, that obviously the scientists are the ones who know, because they're the ones who would have been given access. And through a Canadian scientist named John Hutchison in New Westminster, was levitating cannonballs and Coca-Cola cans in his apartment in New West, and even his neighbor's dishes were floating off the shelves around their apartments, and they would call the RCMP, and they would come and tell him to stop it. And I'm just thinking, are they nuts up there? Nobody can levitate anything. There's nobody who has canceled out the effects of gravity, and here's a guy in Vancouver doing it in his apartment. And I went up to meet John and film him. He looks like Tiny Tim. And his apartment is just lab equipment. I mean, his bathroom, every room in the house, you're crawling around. And History Channel and Discovery Channel go up there, and they film him levitating objects flying around the house. And I'm like, if somebody can do this, you can build a spaceship. Why isn't this all over the news? Why isn't this considered, you know, the most important scientist alive? Because technically we're using rocket engines everywhere, and there's no such thing as anti-gravity. Well, John was being pursued by the interests of a Lockheed Martin senior scientist named Boyd Bushman. And Boyd Bushman, now in his 80s, spent 22 years at Lockheed Martin. He worked for General Dynamics. He's the inventor of Red Eye, which is infrared heat-seeking missiles. He's the father of that technology. Advanced propulsion systems, super advanced weapon systems. He's been following UFOs and anti-gravity for years, and John introduced me to him. And so I drove to Texas with my wife, Crystal, and we interviewed Boyd. And he testified on camera that a friend of his is a Navy doctor who treated a pilot from radiation burns who had just shot down the Roswell flying saucer. This is Navy doctor testimony, and this Navy doctor is still alive today. I mean, this is smoking testimony. And the testimony states, the pilot, this is post-World War II. We don't know what these unfriendly aircraft are. They're flying in our skies. They're faster than us. We have the fastest aircraft on the planet, faster than the Germans, faster than the Russians, faster than anybody. And we can't catch these things. They started appearing in headlines in Kenneth Arnold sees in June of 1947, he sees 9 UFOs over Mount Adams in Washington State. And he's a private pilot, and he sees them, and he reports it, and he's mystified. I mean, somebody has something better than us. And we're not talking aliens yet, because we don't know. The United Airlines pilot in western Idaho and his crew report seeing the same 9 UFOs day later. We're chasing these things on radar all over the country. I have access to over 1,500 pages of real X-Files from the FBI under foia.gov.fbi. You can see all these UFO files, and they're all pages that have a lot of blackout and markings on them under J. Edgar Hoover, who was the director of the FBI at the time. And we're chasing these things. You can see from the reports, we're chasing them all over the place. We're taking them very seriously. And then the UFOs appear over Portland, Oregon. They made all 3 of the Portland newspapers, and they appear on the 4th of July, 9 UFOs over Portland, Oregon. I mean, everybody saw it. This is 1947, Independence Day. It's like the movie, and they're there, and, you know, this should be huge news. Then military officers from Edwards Air Force Base in the Mojave Desert of California, where I skydived for many years, these guys saw the same UFOs on July 8th over Edwards Air Force Base, 9 of them, right over the base. Now, this is going to get really mysterious. Now, when I'm reading these FBI files, J. Edgar Hoover and his staff are obscured by this mess of toy flying saucer sightings. Now, what the heck is this? They don't know what to believe. I mean, are you seeing something, a full-size aircraft, and he has military witnesses saying they saw a UFO flying through the Grand Canyon, and this guy's chasing it in his prop plane, and this UFO dives straight down and shoots down into the canyon, and this is all in the same time period. And then there's a report of a kid whose 30-inch aluminum flying saucer was hovering using anti-gravity technology, crashes into a woman's yard on Magnolia Boulevard in North Hollywood. And the fire department comes because it made her yard catch on fire when it crashed. It's July the 8th. It's the same day as the Roswell incident, or one day later. and the toy flying saucer is flying. Where did this kid get the instructions how to build a flying saucer that really flew using something beyond rocket engines and jet engines? Nobody knows. Jet engines weren't even invented. There was no such thing as a jet engine in 1947. So we don't know what's going on. You know, so this kid worked at Chevron. How did he build a toy flying saucer? And then you find out there's other kids all over the country that were building the same flying saucer. How did they get the same set of instructions? Well, I started to put the pieces together, and it was pretty obvious, because what did the UFO aliens do to me, the Palladians, who were totally human-looking, but very different than us? They're humanoid, but they're not like the Greys at all. Their faces are far more beautiful and human-like than the Greys, and much taller. They were teaching me how to build a flying saucer. Why? Because they knew in our future that we were going to destroy our planet with the technology we were pursuing. Nuclear energy, fossil fuels, oil spills. I mean, it's all very evident right now with the Gulf oil spill. And China just had the biggest oil spill they've ever had. And another million gallons of oil flowed from Canada into the Lake Michigan. And the governor of Michigan ordered a press blackout, and we never heard any more about that. We're destroying our planet. And these aliens, I believe this is what happened. This is my theory about Roswell. Because Boyd, I'm going to go back to Boyd Bushman's testimony in a minute here. We tested the first atomic bomb July 22nd, 1945 at Trinity Site in New Mexico. In July, same month, a few days sooner, July the 7th or the 8th, four UFOs crash, one right near Trinity Site, one at Roswell, which is only, you know, it's just to the east, maybe, you know, in a linear fashion, maybe 100 miles to the east. I've been there. And then there's the plains of St. Augustine and the Corona crash site at New Mexico. Why are all the UFOs crashing in the same place and right near the first atomic blast? I believe when we set off the first atomic bomb, we created a tear in the fabric of space-time, which more primitive, not as evolved, but very evolved flying saucers came through that hole. And I believe they only had so much time to communicate with us what they wanted to do before the hole was closing and before they needed to get back through. And any nuclear scientist can tell you that when you set off an atomic bomb, the intense energy from the gamma radiation, which is the most powerful form of radiation, literally melts dimensions, and the fabric of space itself melts it, just fries it. So I think there was a hole, and the aliens came through unarmed, not ready to fight weapons, advanced weapons, and they were visiting children, trying to teach them how to do this technology so that our future would not be where we are now. And they were racing back towards Roswell and then towards the Trinity site to get back through the hole in the fabric of space-time. And we were chasing them with our technology. Now, Boyd is saying that this young pilot received a radio transmission. He was flying in New Mexico. He launched out of Texas. He was in New Mexico and he sees the flying saucer. He reports back that there's no other aircraft anywhere around. This thing is faster than me. And he's armed with a classified super weapon. Using FBI, FOIA documents, I found that the Tesla death ray, Nikola Tesla was the true father of radio. He invented alternating current motors. Him and George Westinghouse built the first super power plant in Niagara Falls. Tesla invented the foundings of the electron microscope, neon lighting, fluorescent lighting. He redid all of Edison's flickering light bulbs. And Tesla, his lab assistant was Guglielmo Marconi, who actually stole his patent on radio, which Tesla demonstrated at the Chicago World's Fair in 1893. And Marconi took his patent and broadcasted radio signal across the Atlantic and became known as the father of radio. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled June 21, 1943, that Tesla, Lodge, and Stone were the fathers of radio. And Tesla invents a weapon that is known as the death ray. He said it could melt an aircraft engine from 250 miles away. The death ray was in development at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in 1943, 4 years before the Roswell incident. So we know from FBI files that the death ray was feasibly working by 4 years later. And Boyd is saying the Navy doctors said this kid had radiation burns, burn marks from the weapon. It was a beam weapon. It wasn't a bomb. You know, it wasn't. We didn't even have good missiles back then. I don't think we had much of anything but munitions. And bullets are not going to take down a flying saucer. So they told him, this is Boyd's testimony, this is Lockheed Martin, our number one defense contractor. Lockheed is bigger than Boeing. They're bigger than NASA. They're bigger than everybody down here. And they're in Texas. And Boyd is saying this kid is being treated from radiation burns, and he's telling the doctor who's treating him that I just shot this craft down. I didn't know what it was. He landed his plane, and if you go to Roswell, it's just all planes out there. He lands his airplane, and he sees the crash saucer and literally shoots some of the aliens who are alive. And one of them gets away, and he goes inside of the saucer, and he can see through the material. We have translucent aluminum today. We have aluminum that's like glass. It's not as clear as glass, but you can see right through it. And then all of a sudden the military's coming, and he gets in his plane and takes off. And he knows that there's real aliens down there. And I know other people personally that were there that have testified before they died. And they all say the same thing. There were real aliens there. So I believe those aliens, it's really sad what we did. What we did is we killed them. We shot out of the 9 saucers that were zipping around the country and teaching kids how to build flying saucers. We shot down 4 out of 9. And these kids, whoever they are, were obviously abducted from their families and taken to work for the secret divisions of the Air Force and, you know, sequestered and isolated their technology of anti-gravity flying saucers. I mean, this would make an incredible Spielberg movie, but Spielberg doesn't return my calls, so I just put it out there on the radio waves. And it's an incredible story, and all the pieces are there. They were really trying to teach us. So what happened to me in 1968 is these other kids were all gone. I mean, they built their flying saucers. The technology worked. We have it. A lot of the flying saucers we see today are ours. But these kids, nobody knows where they went. Nobody knows who they work for. And so we have this technology. It's sitting there. And there's President Obama saying, you know, we're going to spend billions of dollars in getting Boeing and companies like Lockheed to come up with a better shuttle or something that's lighter and simpler and less expensive to get people up on the space station. And let's go back, because Bill Clinton made this joke to this little kid in a public speaking engagement that asked him this question about the aliens at Roswell. And Bill Clinton said, you know, the Air Force wouldn't tell me about that either, and I want to know. And Bill Clinton, we know from, you know, FOIA releases that he made official inquiries into the UFO subject and the subject at Roswell and didn't get answers. The governor of New Mexico, Richardson, has asked for answers. Congressman Stephen Schiff in New Mexico asked for answers, and he died in his 50s. And a lot of people think he was killed or poisoned because he was making too many serious inquiries. And President Ford, in 1966, he had seen a flying saucer himself, and he was congressman still. He wasn't president yet. He's the first president who had ordered a full congressional investigation into UFOs in 1966 while he was congressman, and we know when he was president, he got much deeper answers into the subject of UFOs. But here we are today. We have a president who doesn't talk about this, and it was laughed about when Senator Kerry brought up the subject in the presidential debates in front of Obama. And Obama said, oh, I don't know about aliens, but, you know, he was bringing it right back down to Earth. This is what we need to do on Earth. And we have this technology, and we're destroying our planet, and we don't want to bring it out because it would solve everything. You could levitate an iceberg and drop it in a dry lake bed. And I'm sitting here, and I know, I believe the blueprints that I was given as a child will work. I have them. I know I can build it, but nobody will give me the money. So I'm eventually going to have to sell a lot of pendants and do it myself. That's one, kind of my first little piece of technology, you know, a little transformer that you can wear around your neck that brightens your aura and raises your physical vibration, which we've proven scientifically. And if I sell enough of those, I'll be able to build my flying saucer. The investment world today is just not passionate. And now, where is the biggest source of money? I mean, investors don't have any money. They have $1 million, $2 million. You know, building a spaceship or building the space shuttle costs hundreds of millions of dollars. And I don't need hundreds of millions of dollars. I need $1 million. And nobody will do this. I mean, nobody in government will say, hey, who has the flying saucer at Area 51? I want to see it. You know, I as a president and as a Congress, I demand to see it now. And you go into, I know who has it. We all know it's Lockheed Martin today who has it. And these scientists at Lockheed say, you know, we can't get enough money to research this flying saucer because when we tell generals about it, all they want is a better missile. And they won't give us money to do more work on the flying saucers that we have from crash retrievals, because Roswell is only one of the saucers that we've shot down with the most classified weapon in American history, which is the modernized Tesla death ray. And Boyd Bushman testifies to me in another interview, which I haven't released yet, that he is the one who's doing the new death ray. It's really kind of sad that Tesla, this great, you know, humanitarian and scientist, ended up fathering a weapon that would be used to shoot down aliens. Well, Tesla died July the 8th, 1943. He was born on July the 8th, his birthday is July the 8th. He died on January the 8th, 1943. And he was supposed to have a meeting with President Roosevelt the next day about the death ray. But the death ray was already in development at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Now, where, and I have that on paper from the FBI files, where was the Roswell flying saucer taken? It was taken first to Los Alamos, which was brand new at the time in New Mexico, and then it went to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Sounds like there's a cell phone going on in the background.
Yeah, I just had to turn it off. So the Roswell flying saucer ends up at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the home of the weapon that shot it down. I'm putting all these little pieces together, and I'm the first one to tell this particular theory about Roswell. This is my theory. This is years and years of research about what had happened and how they tried to help us. So why in 1968 were they telling me at 7 years old how to build a flying saucer's propulsion drive, its anti-gravity and interstellar propulsion drive? I didn't understand anything. I'm only seven. Because they knew they would put it so deep in my brain I would remember it, you know, for my whole life. And it's also because the other kids that they gave the blueprints to failed to get that technology to the world. So for me, enlightenment is not just, you know, I'm just going to go into bliss and I'm just going to party in this bliss state and just fly around the universe in my consciousness. No, my mission is to ground that consciousness and put it into technology that's going to bring us as a human race into an interstellar race so that we can visit other star systems in our own galaxy and eventually become intergalactic. And there are clearly very advanced extraterrestrial civilizations that can go intergalactic between galaxies, which are, our nearest galaxy is Andromeda, which is 2.2 million light years away from here. So we can't even dream of doing the speed of light now. And I figured out how they do it and how they don't move through space. I figured out exactly how they move, and one of the reasons mainstream physicists cannot accept faster than light travel, because they're stuck in a tin can moving, pushing against the fabric of space-time, and and with a rocket propulsion system or jet drive, and they'll never get anywhere like that. That's not how they do it. And now it's gotten deeper with the crop circle phenomena. I mean, this gets much deeper for me. I mean, my contact ended there with the Pleiadians for a long time. And when I was living in a yurt in Topanga Canyon in between tree planting in Canada and working for Department of Defense in Orange County for these physicists, in the middle of the night, after my visit with Jesus Christ, which we talked about in the last show, which was in October of 1994, I could instantly see invisible beings. I saw ghosts, I saw Princess Diana, I've seen Einstein. I've seen hundreds and hundreds of invisible beings. And so it wasn't like, you know, one or two things that happened. It was happening all the time. My life was like a science fiction movie. And I woke up in the middle of the night, and there's these three balls of light. One is fuchsia, one is violet, blue, and one is white. And they're about this bigger than basketballs, and they're hovering in front of me. And my yurt is, you know, it's the size of a normal bedroom with high ceilings, and it's built on a deck. It's not that primitive. But they're hovering there, and I look at them, and they talk to me, and they tell me what star system they're from. They said, "We're Arcturians." And I said, "Arcturians?" I said, I don't know where that is. I never heard of this star system called Arcturus in the Boots constellation, which I researched in the following days. And it turns out, you know, I got scared. They took off. I fell asleep, and I went out of body, and I saw their spaceships, which were hundreds of miles across in size. I'm cruising over Southern California in a higher dimensional level of reality, invisible to our detection systems. And they're here. They're cruising by. And years later, you know, you see these little balls of light that were captured on video in crop circles, these fuzzy little balls of light. And there's this great shot in this movie by William Gazeki called Crop Circles, The Quest for the Truth. And you see this farmer, this kid, he's on his tractor, and this fuzzy ball of light comes right up to him, and it buzzes around, falls asleep in the middle of the day. The thing just puts him to sleep. And they came up and interviewed the kid later, and he told him, he said, you know, he saw this freaking ball of light coming towards them, and it just put him to sleep. Well, my friend Joseph Mark Cohen, who lives in Nelson, British Columbia, incredible crop circle researcher, he spent a lot of time in the crop circles in the fields, and he's saying, you know, we know the balls of light are the aliens, and they're Arcturians. They're from Arcturus. And these guys all know about Arcturians, and I'm like, I saw them years ago in my yurt, and they told me where they were from. And they're telling me these are the same balls of light. They look the same, except the ones I saw were in color. And now many people have captured the balls of light on film and video in the fields. And what we believe, the message in the field is a set of blueprints teaching us higher dimensional physics. Higher dimensional, literally, if you think of the movie Contact with Jodie Foster, they're putting blueprints in the fields. And there's an amazing guy. I was interviewed for a big film on crop circles. It's going to be in movie theaters. And there's a guy that took a crop circle and spun it in AutoCAD, and it revealed a set of blueprints for a flying saucer. And I looked at him, and I said, those are the same as my blueprints. And they're very similar. I mean, not identical, but they're very close. And I said, yeah, I know what that means, and we can build that. They literally put the blueprints in the crop circle. You just had to put it in a three-dimensional AutoCAD program and spin it, and all of a sudden you see it. There it is. There's the generator for the flying saucer.
Wow. So, David, but how do you know the difference between the hoax crop circles and the real ones? Because I've seen videos on how people have created even the balls of light and a hoax video on, like,
well, see, the hoaxers are funded by the government, so they're going to come in and try to, you know, show how they create a ball of light in a 3D, you know, special effects program. But there's nothing better than eyewitness testimony. When you know a person that you trust really well and they tell you, this is what we saw, and this is what happened. They look for the exploded nodes on the real crop circles. When the paddle boards come down, they break the nodes, and so they know those are fake. the geometries, and you know, I do a lot of mathematics on crop circles, and because my works on the hidden harmonic codes of the universe begs me to do it. And I can tell from the math, because the ratios are so harmonic and so perfect. I say there's no way that a hoaxer, and when you know, like Doug and Dave, the two famous hoaxers in Great Britain, these guys were just a joke. I mean, they're beer drinking, boozing guys. They don't know anything about sacred geometry and mathematics. So their crop circles were really laughable. But the hoaxers got better. And in fact, Colin Andrews, the legendary British crop circle researcher, was with me. We're both being interviewed for this new film that's going to come out. And he said, yeah, we know most of them are fake, but they're so good at knowing which ones are real. And this is mind-blowing what I'm going to tell you. This is like his deepest secret that doesn't seem to get in television interviews. Nobody seems to know this, that Colin knows that most of the time he walks into a circle, it's going to be fake. So when they see a real one, they get really excited. They know there's no way. And plus the eyewitness testimony of the orbs of light and the videotapings of the helicopters chasing the orbs of light, they know it's real. Now, of course, special effects guys can do anything, so they say, well, because I can do this, then it's fake. So let's look at eyewitness testimony. I know what I saw in Berkeley that day. There's nobody doing special effects back then, and so nobody could create a hologram or a holographic projection of what I saw back then. They can't even do it now. So if I shot video of it today, someone would say, oh, that's just special effects, because a special effects guy can do it. But I'm pretty darn good at knowing how the real UFOs move, what their movements are like, which are very, very, very subtle, the way the light plays off of the metallic structures. I know what a real one looks like, and there are definitely a lot of fakes out there. But what Colin Andrews told me is this. This blew my mind. When I was sitting next to him, I was saying, how come I've never heard that before? And here's what happened. Princess Diana and Prince Charles asked Colin Andrews on the phone for a private tour of the fields that summer. And he said, there is nobody listening to this conversation. Colin told me, I didn't tell anybody. The next day, all over the tabloids, on the news was Princess Diana and Prince Charles are going to get a tour of the crop circles with Colin Andrews. He said, I didn't tell anybody. And he said they canceled the tour with him because it ended up in the papers and they thought he did it. He knew his phones were tapped. So he said, I can't talk about this anymore on the phone when you get to that level of, you know, having the royal family wanting a tour.
Wow.
So Colin then, I never heard this anywhere, so he told me that they know the hoaxer so well that one night they caught the hoaxers before they were going to make their circle. And he told them that you're going to do a flower of life tomorrow. We know the geometry and everything. So the hoaxers just sat around drinking beer all night with them and said, you know, you caught us, so we're not going to go do all that work because you already know it's going to be faked. The next morning they woke up and there was a flower of life crop circle there, and then nobody knows who did it. Okay, so that's number one. That's not even the big one. The hoaxers, they know all the hoaxers, and they're just sitting there, and they gave up, and yet that geometry appeared in the field, and when they tested it, it was definitely a real one. Then Colin says, I'm still not convinced, because, you know, what if somebody's cell phone or whatever, somebody was wiretapped. So Colin goes home, and he doesn't pick up his phone, he just mentally, He looks at all the geometries of everything that's been made, and he says, telepathically, he doesn't verbalize it, so if he's got a bug in his apartment, nobody can hear him because he's not saying anything. He says to them to create a Celtic cross, crop circle. And he doesn't tell a soul. The next morning he gets a call, there's a Celtic cross, crop circle. And that's when he went, oh my God, it's real. They
wow.
can hear our thoughts. And there's no way the frickin' military is listening to their thoughts and making the design of what he just said in his mind. And that's when he says, okay, it's real. It's 100% real. And they're really listening to us. And he knew about the Arcturian connection as well. So Arcturus is in the Boots constellation. You can look it up. You can see it's one of the brighter stars in the sky. And that's, I met them myself. So when here's my testimony. I don't have any videotape. Nobody, video cameras that I use can't see into the invisible where I'm seeing spirits. But I saw them perfectly clearly with my eyes open. They're not, I'm not dreaming, it's there. They're talking to me in English. And I know those are the same spheres of light that end up in the fields. So it's real. They're really, they're trying to teach us. They're teaching us a quantum physics lesson in the fields. And if you know the language of quantum physics, which is just spinning particles, leaving trails, geometries, you know how to look at what is a real crop circle, because you know when you do the math on it, you go, this is amazing what they're teaching me here, because I know this language. I know this language of spinning particles and what that particle means and what that spin ratio means and what the harmonic code is of that. So that's how I determine if they're real. And then once you find a real one, you're looking at a two-dimensional image printed against a flat plane of crop, and you put it in these three-dimensional programs, you can start to see what they're trying to teach us.
Awesome. Well, David, we've been speaking for almost 2 hours, and I'm wondering, are you ready for a quick break?
Yeah, let's have a little break.
Okay.
How much time do I have?
Let's say 2 to 3 minutes.
Okay.
Okay.
We'll
talk to you in a minute.
Okay.
So we are speaking with David Sarita right now, and if you want to connect with him online, he is on Facebook, or you can find his website, voiceentertainment.net, or lightstreamtechnologies.com. Lightstreamtechnologies.com is just where he has information about the quantum harmonic crystal jewelry that he briefly mentioned, and there's a PDF document with more information about that, and his main website is voiceentertainment.net. And just in case you're tuning in for the first time, I should let you know that Namaste Radio is actually brought to you by Namaste Publishing. And Namaste Publishing is the original publisher of Eckhart Tolle and his book, The Power of Now. And Namaste has a global community with a slew of blogs and beautiful, wonderful information from all of the authors, as well as David Ord has a daily almost blog that he participates in, The Compassionate Eye, where we also have guest bloggers who contribute material to that. So go to namastepublishing.com if you're interested in connecting. And if you're enjoying this show, Namaste Radio, please favorite the show, connect with us, and you can also find us on Facebook as well. I believe it's facebook.com/namastepublishing. So we will be back with more on our discussion with David Sarita in about 2 minutes. Here's a song inspired by the work of Eckhart Tolle, inspired by his book, A New Earth, and it is called Brand New World, here on Namaste Radio.
There's a new wind blowing across the earth. It's bringing with it a brand new birth. Lamb and the lion will lay down. They will live together in a brand new world. Nature's crying with tears of
All right. Welcome back to Namaste Radio. Again, if you would like to connect with Namaste's global community, go to namastepublishing.com. Namaste Publishing is the original publisher of Eckhart Tolle, and we have all of his books available on namastepublishing.com. And also, if you are interested in the topic of Jesus, which we have been discussing in great length here on today's show, there is also a book called Your Forgotten Self, Mirrored in Jesus the Christ, and you can find that as well at namastepublishing.com, and that is authored by David Robert Ord. He is the creator of the Compassionate Eye blog, as well as the Sunday blog on namastepublishing.com. So please do join us there. Everything at namastepublishing.com, all of the blogs and communication, our spiritual dictionary, and all of that, it's all free to participate and get involved. So thank you so much, namastepublishing.com. And we are speaking with David Sarita today. If you would like to connect with him, he's on Facebook, and you can also go to his website, voiceentertainment.net. He has a number of really wonderful films there and more information on how to contact and connect with him. Welcome back to the show, David.
Yeah, good to be back, our last hour.
Yes, thank you so much. I'm going to let you decide on what you want to talk about, but we have had a question about 2012 and what you see happening for that. Is there something that you wanted to focus on for this last hour?
Well, 2012 is a huge subject. You know, maybe we could do a whole show on that because that's enormous. And, you know, I was not previously a believer in dates, but I've seen more interesting evidence, especially looking at astronomy, that something really be coming to a head. I mean, whether it's on exactly that date, I don't know, but there definitely is a major transformation going on in the solar system's position in the galaxy. So we can kind of tease people with that and then maybe later set some point to a show on 2012.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I have an ebook on my website called Quantum Electrodynamics in 2012. So if you, I compare subatomic particle models to solar system models to galactic models to see what will really happen on that date. So you can, if you want to take a look at that, you can get it there at voiceentertainment.net. But one of the things I wanted to talk about more in singularity is how, you know, we go from a very organic human being that's very earthbound to miracles and great, great powers, or what the yogis call siddhis. And there's nowhere better than the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Philip, where Jesus gives us this secret to how to produce the great powers and miracles and actually how they manifested. And we looked at, in the last show, I described how quantum physicists have now discovered that information is more powerful than energy, and energy is more powerful than matter. Einstein said the field is the sole governing agency of the particle, matter. And in Einstein's world, he's basically saying that energy as a form of, in a field or an aura, is more powerful than the flesh, because the field is telling the flesh or the matter what to do. But now quantum physicists have gone further and they say information tells energy what to do, which then subsequently tells matter what to do. So when we look at miracles, we're looking at how do we transform healing, how do we teleport from, you know, one part of the world to another, how can a master appear in two places at the same time, and these types of things. And, you know, how come at times Jesus' body was literally immaterial, and yet he appeared in front of the disciples, but they would just, you know, put their hand right through him. And this language of knowing that information tells energy what to do, which tells the body what to do, all you have to do to look at what information is, what its structure is, all you got to do is look in the mirror, matter. You just got to look at the structure of matter to see what the structure of the information is, because the information is telling the matter to be in that structure. And it turns out that the structure of matter is dual. It's duality. It's the knowledge of good and evil in the reflection in the mirror. And so we know that good and evil, the polarity matrix, is that information in our consciousness pulled the atoms in our body to be in a polarity matrix, which is why the double helix of the DNA, why it's given the instructions to age and to die. And we know in the Old Testament, God warned, if you ever take in this knowledge of good and evil, you will actually die. But also, Jesus tells John in the Apocryphon of John, that when you take in this knowledge, you'll be cast to the lowest region of matter. Not the lowest region of the universe geographically, but the lowest region of matter itself. And that's what I was talking about in the caller's question. What sets up the polarity matrix of the human cell and the human organism push against the instantaneous velocity of light and slow it down to the speed we see it at is the instructions we're giving our DNA and our cellular biology right now. And it turns out that, as the great quantum physicist Paul Dirac discovered, it's because matter is in this dual state of positive and negative, electron, positron, proton, antiproton, tau, antitau, muon, antitau, everywhere you look in the quantum universe, everything we're made of is in the polarity matrix. It turns out that's why it can't travel faster than the speed of light, which is why we're stuck in the lowest region of matter, which is what Jesus told John. I mean, Jesus was speaking in a language that was so far ahead of his time. No one could understand what he was talking about, so they didn't canonize this language of duality and singularity. So what I say is, it's not enough to understand, just to try to drop the bomb of oneness on a person's consciousness is almost impossible for them to perceive. What is oneness? You know, we're just going to create a big circular projection of self and see what fits inside of the circle as one and what doesn't. And then we're going to try to make everything one and put it in that circle, and it doesn't work. So you have to understand what these polarity matrices are doing. You have to really understand, first, that the polarity matrix is in your consciousness. And it's really there. And the proof that we took in the knowledge of good and evil is evident every day when we have an argument with ourself. So how many of you have ever sat there on the bus or in your car and you're arguing with yourself? And how many of you have ever won an argument with yourself? And how many of you have ever compulsively argued with yourself about whether you should do this or do that? That's the polarity matrix in action. There it is, working inside of you. And what it's actually doing is wasting all of your energy. It's burning it up in this conflict energy field. And that's what Jesus said to me in person causes the force field of the elliptical or oval shape of the cocoons that I saw hovering above the earth. And that positive and negative field is spinning. And in people who have really strong polarity matrices or egos, who really believe they're right and the other guy's wrong, or the other girl's wrong, they're the ones who have a thicker shield around them. And that shield is so defensive. It's constantly in defense mode because it's always trying to prove the other guy wrong. And it loves to fight because that's just its nature. The more we hold on to that structure, the more we're trapped in duality. And that duality prevents us from experiencing the peace of non-duality. And the true peace of non-duality means the true peace of non-violence. Because you have to have a conflict in order to have violence come out of it. So there's Jesus in the Gospel of Thomas speaking in this language, and this is I didn't have this in front of me last time, so I want to read these more purely. He says, quote, "When you are in the light, what will you do on the day when you were one, you became two? But when you become two, what will you do?" And Jesus is forlorning here because he knows in the light it was simple. We were all originally created in the first clear light, but some of us got bored in that light because it's not full enlightenment. And out of the nature of being bored, of being in that first level of bliss consciousness, some of us took in the knowledge of good and evil because we wanted to decide for ourselves what is right and what is wrong. We got sucked into that whole game of conflict. We became the conflict. We started radiating the conflict. And therefore, our information band of our soul told the atoms in our body to be in the polarity matrix. And so, therefore, they couldn't produce any miracles. They couldn't dematerialize and move through walls. We couldn't heal because a diseased body is a body that's in a state of conflict. In fact, its cells are in so much conflict that they produce cancer. They produce diseases because the conflict is so real to that body and that consciousness. And what's even worse is when we're born in a body that already has the polarity matrix imprinted in it, we come in as consciousness, and what do we do? We look at the body, and we look at the body, and we go, "Oh, that hurts. Oh, that feels good." And we're already doing what the body's telling. The body's telling us what to do because it's already got the imprint, which makes the delusion reinforcing. It stays there. And when Paul Dirac, the quantum physicist, discovered the singular C of what he called pure negative, it didn't have a positive inside of it. And he realized that if you were one with that C, you could physically travel instantaneously anywhere in the universe, because if there's no polarity, there's resistance to movement, everything's instantaneous. He realized there's no aging of the cell because there's no resistance. If there's no resistance in the cell, then it's going to live forever. And in a way, he had inadvertently discovered God. Paul Dirac had discovered the scientific proof that the oneness of God existed, and it's a real place. It's verifiably real. He saw subatomic particles in their dual state become single and go into it and disappear into the singular sea. But he was way ahead of his time. But when you realize what the miracles were, when Jesus could put his hand on a person and make a disease just disappear, it was very clear that his consciousness was one. It was single. There is no duality in it. So when he looks at a person's body that's stuck in duality, he can look at the disease, the physical disease, the conflict, and make it single, just temporarily, so that person could temporarily have a new set of instructions in their DNA, and their cancer would go away. Their eyesight would be regained. This was easy for Jesus to do, from what I saw. This, and he's making galaxies and planets and stars for fun, and you know, curing a human being is utterly nothing for him to do this. And so when Jesus could, in the same second, to all three of his disciples, and this is in Gnostic literature, in the New Testament Apocrypha by Wilhelm Schleiermacher, the same second the disciples are all looking at him, and one of them sees him as a child, an infant, one of them sees him as an old man, and one of them sees him as a young man, and they're all arguing, saying, well, he looks like this, no, he looks like that, no, he looks like this. How did he have such mastery over the appearance of the aging of the human body? Because in a state of non-duality, there's no conflict. The moving the atomic structure around to appear any age is absolutely a cinch. And this is really exciting for me, because when I realized what singularity meant, is that when Alan Guth and Stephen Hawking were saying that you can't prove the Big Bang happened, because you can't explain the moment before it happened. Because all we know is there was this Big Bang, and we can measure the first 100,000 seconds, 10 seconds after the Big Bang, but we don't know what happened before it. Now let's look at time, because this is a very deep thing that Jesus is doing. In the same second, he's appearing in different moments in time to the same disciples in the same second. He's appearing as the infant, and he's appearing as the old man and the young man, all in the same second. And from the perspective of singularity, you see, in order to have time, you have to have this concept of something aging, of something moving, even. And in the singular universe, because there's no resistance to movement at all, everything is one, what happens is that the moment the first duality pair forms in the universe, in this pure void, the two spheres, the positive and the negative, slam against each other and produce out of this infinitum of singularity. And in singularity, there's no energy, because you have to have mass to have energy. It's really amazing. There is no energy. There's no star. There's no planet. There's no body. There's nothing. So in this singularity, all of a sudden a duality is born, the first one, and it, the positive and negative slam into each other, but they're fueled by this infinitum of energy potential from the singularity. So the explosion is enormous. And as soon as you have one wave pushing against another wave, what do you have? You have the slowing down of singularity. Because singularity is instantaneous, and now two instantaneous waves hit each other, a positive and a negative, and they push against each other, and you have the birth of time. So as soon as time is born, out of resistance, you have this conflict in the physical universe that's going to start aging. It's already starting to die. It's already, even though the explosion is ensuing and all the subatomicals are born, hydrogen is born, you know, 10 or 20 seconds after the Big Bang, which is the building block of galaxies and stars and eventually humans, and all living things have hydrogen. What's amazing is the more dense this cosmic soup gets of the universe, the more resistance there is, light has to start slowing down because it's pushing against something. And so when Jesus says, when you are in the light, what will you do? On the day when you were one, you became two. But when you become two, what will you do? He's talking about a different light. He's talking about a light, the kind of light in the consciousness that we were talking about in the experience earlier. He's not talking about the light of the suns and the light of the stars. And light came into being after the first polarity matrix. Light is the positive side of the polarity matrix. The background of space, or Einstein's cosmological constant, is producing negative pressure, and the light is producing positive pressure. And because positive and negatives are always attracted to each other, they rush against each other and they put pressure on each other. So time is born, and suddenly you say, well, the reason we can't explain the moment before the Big Bang is because there's no time. You can't explain anything until time is born. Time is born upon the first duality. And then all of a sudden everything starts slowing down, and the soup in the background of the universe, the fabric, becomes a matrix, a real maya, an illusion that you're trapped in. You think there's this thing called time because when a cell or an atomic structure encounters resistance, the resistance wears it out. It tires out the cell. It becomes exhausted. So how many humans feel exhausted, you know, just living, just trying to keep this whole thing going, trying to keep this body alive and your job and your career? We're exhausted because we were trained to think in this consciousness. It was embedded in our bodies. So when people say that Adam and Eve is a myth and, you know, there never was such a thing as taking in the knowledge of good and evil, the Adam and Eve part of the characters is not a myth. It's a deep truth. It's something that happened on the spiritual plane first and then eventually became physical. And so therefore, our information inside of ourselves, now this is what you can do. When you're arguing with yourself, which is what you do before you argue with somebody else, what is that? It's just information. You're attaching yourself to this information that you're getting in a fight with yourself about. You're trying to say, is this right or is that right? Should I do this or should I do that? And you go, and there are some that we obsessive compulse about, and people who develop obsessive compulsive disorders can burn so much of their psychic energy, they go into vast energy deficiencies, and they become depressed. And depression is when you have a huge energy loss, because we're obsessive compulsive about a problem, or about a trauma, or something that happened to us. And we all have this. Every one of us has this. So the question is, who's in charge of that information? Who has to believe it? That we need to answer what is right and what is wrong for me right now. Why do I have to come up with the answer? And we realize that our consciousness is in charge of that conflict that's going on inside of us right now. There's nobody else in charge. Society has the external pressure, the oppression, the outside force, and the suppression is the internal force that is in charge of the information. And now you know whenever you're having an argument with yourself, you're going to have an argument with somebody else as soon as that issue becomes agitated in the presence of another person. And when you argue with somebody else, you're going to get inflamed and you're going to be screaming and yelling and throwing pots and pans around. And when it gets really bad, we go to war with other countries because this argument is severe. But who's in charge of that? It's not God. It's not anybody. It's us. We are attached to being right about this conflict. So when we realize that, that's real attachment. This is what the Buddha is talking about, attachment. You know, when we hear these masters come from the West and they say, you're too attached to your dog or you love your wife too much, don't do that. That will ruin your meditation. I guarantee you it will ruin your meditation. I did that. I didn't celebrate my first girlfriend's birthday anymore. I didn't celebrate my birthday anymore, and it doesn't lead you anywhere. Trying to become completely unattached. That is not the answer. The answer is you can learn how to, and this is, if you go to my website and learn the meditation, the insight meditation level 1 and then level 2, the first part of the meditation is to learn to make contact with the conflict. Don't try to just go into straight oneness. That'll be a very superficial oneness. You can't do it. You have to identify the conflict first and realize who is in charge of this conflict and make contact with the presence of who is in charge of it. Don't make it an idea. Stay with the feeling. Who is in charge of this conflict? Again, Jesus says in the Gospel of Thomas, when you are in the light, what will you do? On the day when you were one, you became two. But when you become two, what will you do? He knows when you become attached to this, you're really in trouble. In the Gospel of Philip, Jesus says, in this world there is good and evil. Its good things are not good, and its evil things not evil. Now, when the first, you know, church fathers read that, they said, Jesus is saying evil isn't evil, and good isn't good. Oh, my God, we got to throw this out. This doesn't make any sense. Because they don't understand. He's speaking in this language that good and evil are subjective. They don't exist. They only exist because you made them exist. Because you're holding it. You're so attached to your idea of my religion's the right run. God is on my side. He's not. And oh my God, you're going to go to hell because you got it wrong. And that's a very primitive conflict. That's like, you know, caveman and cavewoman mentality. There are much deeper levels of the conflict
right now.
What's that?
You say it's very primitive, but this is what we're experiencing on a daily basis right now.
Well, we're a very primitive planet. But I'm talking about, let's go into relationship. I mean, this is a simple one. First chakra conflict. You know, you're attracted to a potential lover and you go, oh, they don't care about me. Oh, I should ask them. Oh, forget it. I'm not going to ask them out. You see, that's the conflict at work at a very basic level. And when we obsessive compulse about that, when we come in the presence of someone who really, really lights us up and we're really attracted to them, we waste all of our energy in the conflict. And if we just exploded in ecstasy, because we didn't have any resistance to this big burst of joy we felt, you don't lose anything. That person may be afraid of your ecstasy, and if they are, then they're not right for you anyway. And if they embrace your overwhelming feelings for them, then wonderful. Then you go into this state of oneness together. Very, very simple level of the conflict. The first three chakras are all about the basic survival mechanisms of relationship. You know, the second chakra, the belly center, is, you know, we were connected to our mother's womb for 9 months through this center. And wherever we have issues and fear about money and poverty or sudden rejection, our sudden abandonment, we feel this buzzing in our belly. We get all nervous in the stomach and our intestines get all knotted up, there's the conflict, right? We see it working. When you get to the third chakra, your adrenal glands, this area gets really dead when people are not interested in anything. And this happens on the spiritual path when they tell us, don't be attached to anything. And so you're not interested in anything, so you don't develop anything. And you sit there. You don't even have the energy to hold your body up in the meditation pose because you're trying to be unattached. And so you go into this conflict about, should I push it away or should I keep it? Should I attract it or should I push it away? See, attraction, repulsion. that whole dynamic goes on in the third chakra, and that's our adrenals. When you get to the heart chakra, it's much more terrifying, because when the heart gets engaged in relationship and it bonds, this heart is meant to go deeper and deeper and deeper into love. It's not meant to be ripped out of its socket. So when gurus from India come and say, oh, you can't be in a relationship, you need to be celibate, and if you want to get this enlightenment, and we dump our boyfriend or our girlfriend, or we're aloof, we don't express any love to them. I've seen people do that for years, for as many years as I've been meditating, for 30 years, and they didn't get any samadhi, nothing. And yet, the supermasters are all in divine couple pairs. So figure that one out. The romantic love and the heart bonding is going, that love, that feeling of the love is going to eventually go beyond the pairedness of the human relationship, and it's just going to get deeper and go into the cosmic. It's going to go into the devotional and the love of the master-disciple relationship, and it's going to go into the cosmos. There's no reason to push it away. That's why when I met the real Buddhist in India, they said, no, you got on attachment wrong. No, non-attachment means don't push it away and don't cling. Just watch the nature of the mind, that everything is impermanent. So don't cling to anything too tightly, but yet experience everything. And it turns out that the real issue in the conflict is the same as St. Francis's, is when you stop wasting your energy on these conflicts, suddenly your real problem is now is I got all this joy and I don't know what to do with it because society doesn't have anywhere for me to be this blissed out. You know, I can't be like this. I can't look at somebody and start weeping with love for them because I see their soul the way God sees them. And we're not trained for this kind of ecstasy in our society. And that's even, you see this in children. You see this with parents, and their kids are going insane with laughter, and they're running around the yard in circles, and the parents are, stop, and, you know, shut up, and don't make all that noise, and they grab them, and the kid starts crying because the parent doesn't know what it's like to be that madly happy running around the yard and laughing their head off. So they kill the ecstasy in the child because they say, you know, we don't know how to deal with that. But when the levels of ecstasy get really smooth and beyond the child's ecstasy and going into much higher, because the child is basically born in the, pretty much in the first samadhi, the first clear light. Because most of us go to the first clear light when we die. Yes, the first clear light is there for most of us. There are people who are afraid of it permanently and they live in it for a little while. The Buddhists also say many of us go to the first clear light after we die and we get bored of it and we want to come back to suffer more so that eventually we can develop compassion so we can go to the next higher and higher light. So the conflicts are, this is what my dad was teaching me. He said, you know, you think just ending the conflict and being in this kind of peaceful zone is where it is. When you sit in meditation in that zone long enough and you get these explosions of mad ecstasy and love, and then you try to repress that, you're not going to go any further. You have to learn how to live in that state and not repress it and go into deeper and deeper levels of that madness, playground, magical child state that we've all just suppressed in our society. We say, no, you can't. You got to be, you know, organized and calm and collected in society. And you can't have these mad outbursts of ecstasy running around. So that's where it gets even more challenging. And then when the heart gets really, really deep and you start, and this happened to me in one of the 10-day Buddhist Vipassanas as I was, you're sitting in silence and you're meditating 12 hours a day and I'm looking at my banana and the banana in the lunch table is so cosmic. I'm going, oh my God, this banana is like the whole universe. And I looked up at the people and I saw them in this field. Oh my God, their souls were so beautiful. I saw each one of them and felt them so deeply, I started crying, and I went into the forest to hide because I found it so difficult to look at them and see how beautiful they were and not go mad of just expressing to them how beautiful they were, because we were told to be silent and don't laugh and just look down and don't gaze in each other's eyes at the Buddhist retreat. And then you see the laughing Buddha statue and you go, well, why is the Buddha laughing when he's supposed to be quiet? Well, it's because when you have a Satori, as they call it in Japan, you just start ripping, you know, with laughter. You see that you're in this state and it's like, oh my God, it's so incredible. So this is where St. Francis found the levels of the conflict are way more challenging when you're exploding with love than you are when you're just calm and collected and, you know, you're just learning to meditate. Much harder to deal with all that compassion for all beings than it is to just sit there in a gentle meditation. So it gets harder. And then you reach levels where you're so one with everything, you just want to serve. You just want to help others. And you, or whether it's the environment, for me it was the environment. I found it very difficult to help humans because everybody has their own ideas of how they want to be helped. So I'm like, okay, I'm just going to go plant trees and clean up oil spills because to do something with this passion for life that engages me, you know, with other beings. This morning I was cleaning out my swimming pool, the dead leaves, and I've had three chipmunks die here because they drown in the pool. And I see this little guy, he's in my, because my jacuzzi is like, it's like all this green algae in it because I haven't used it in months, and he's stuck in the water and he's like trying to jump out of the jacuzzi and he keeps falling back in. I'm like, I thought it was a rat, and I went, oh my God, it's a chipmunk. And I ran and I grabbed the net and I rushed and I scooped him out of the jacuzzi and I set him on the side and the water's just pouring off of this poor little guy. I mean, my heart was burning, this poor little guy. And I was so glad that finally I was there to save one of these guys because I've had three of them die that I buried. And instead of, like, he didn't run away from me in fear as the chipmunks will normally do. He is just, like, breathing and the water's pouring. He looked at me like, wow, you saw me? And then he just kind of took his breath and he slowly walked away and he went home.
Aww.
You know, it's just those little guys, you realize that's me. You know, we're in this together. You know, this is this idea of non-attachment where you just sit back and I was in India, and this is in 1996. This is a very terrible story, but we were a Buddhist nun and I and some others were in a taxi, and we're going up to the Dalai Lama's in Dharamsala, and we're going up the hill, and our taxi driver and his front passenger are chatting away, and there's a bunch of dogs that come running so happy to greet us in the car because they hadn't seen a car in so long, and they just drove over the dogs and killed them and kept on driving. And I looked behind and went, oh my God, stop. The dogs are like broken bones and they're weeping and yelping. And I don't speak Hindi, so the drivers just keep driving along. And that's his idea of non-attachment. The Buddha says this is the wrong idea of you don't remove yourself from life and say we're so unattached that it was that dog's destiny to die because I drove right through him and I was too lazy to hit the brakes. That's not the right idea of non-attachment. Buddha is saying, no, you've got it all wrong. When you're really unattached, you're going to have so much compassion, so much love, because you are the other. Your hearts are together. You're not going to run over the dog. That is the flawed interpretation of non-duality, the Buddha says in the Lankavatara Sutra.
David,
and
I,
so,
I want to ask you about the chipmunk. You said that when you first saw the chipmunk, at first you thought it was a rat. And I'm curious, if it had turned out to be a rat, would you have treated it the same as the...
I was scared of the rat idea because, you know, they're big teeth and, you know, maybe he's going to run after me. Because it looked kind of big. It was, you know, like, you know, a squirrel. Like a chipmunk's like a little baby squirrel. And I was actually afraid of the rat idea, but... Because I've had a couple of rats die also. But nevertheless, whether it was a rat or a chipmunk, I couldn't tell. I grabbed the net and I ran because I thought of the three chipmunks that I buried, and it turns out it was a little striped chipmunk. Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to ask because sometimes we...
I would have got him as a rat, but there was fear at the front of the rat concept. But because I wanted to get... The little guy was trying to jump out of the water. But nevertheless, the chipmunk I have no fear of. And in fact, I call my wife Chipmunk sometimes because she has a lot of the mannerisms of a little chipmunk. How fast their minds are and how quickly they move around. But that's a good question too, yeah, because you know, if you saw a bear and he was stuck in the water, would you go help him, you know? Well, that's even deeper. I can't, you know, obviously a rat is not going to hurt me, but there's just that, you know, that kind of conditioning that you know, what rats are. But when I was in India, I saw this everywhere. I saw the two schools of thought in India, you know, the Sikhs and Himachal Pradesh were so clean and beautiful, healthy people. Even though they were poor, every one of their yards was immaculate. And on the Hindu side, everything was filthy and destroyed, and there was no care that went into property or people or anything. It was this total aloofness. And this is where, you know, Buddha, when he attained nirvana, and Buddha was from Nepal, and he taught in India, there are people who think the Buddha was poisoned because he abolished the worship of the demigods, and he really didn't believe in the ideas of non-attachment of certain sects of Hinduism. Krishna absolutely does not teach that. Krishna is all about love and devotion and care. So there are different schools of thought in India. But I could really see it. It was really evident that why do anything? Why even sweep the floor? Because it doesn't matter. You know, I'm just going to be... And I did that for years. I meditated in Vancouver in that state, and I lost my girlfriend because I was so unattached to her, and I was just saying, okay, I burned all my photographs that I had gallery showings of in Vancouver, and I said, okay, where's the bliss? You know, where's God? And I would just sit there and meditate like that, and nothing would happen. And it wasn't until I really understood non-attachment correctly that it really started to shift. The meditation started to get much, much better. You don't want to reject anything. The things that need to fall by the wayside will fall by themselves. And you know, you don't pick a tomato off the vine before it's ripe. It's so connected and nurtured by the vine, and when it's ripe, it detaches naturally. And it becomes an independent tomato. It has its own seeds now. You can eat it. You can grow other tomatoes with it. But if you pick it too soon and you detach too soon, it's not going to be a real tomato. And that's how we are. You know, we need to be loved and nurtured and held by each other. And when we're fully, fully loved, it's much easier when you meditate to go into cosmic consciousness.
So, David, it's interesting what you said earlier about feeling that love and that connection and how that's harder than just peacefully meditating on nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And it brought up a question because I know many people who there seems to be kind of some confusion and some conflict in this whole spiritual realm. There are people who meditate often and read all the spiritual books, and then, frankly, they're not very nice, kind people. They sort of, like you said, they have that non-attachment of like, well, if I say something awful to you and you are hurt by that, well, that's your problem. It's nothing to do
right.
with anything that I did. It's
yeah.
You need to work on yourself. And then there are people who don't meditate at all, don't go to church, don't do any kind of spiritual practice, who are very compassionate and are out there helping the environment or animals or other, you know, homeless people or whatever. So how do you,
if you don't feel anything.
Do you have to be a meditator to feel that compassion and love for fellow beings?
No, there are people whose predisposition is it's not going to work for them in this life to sit still in many hours of meditation. They're more the devotional types who just have so much compassion. They're going to be experiencing their heart in every one and every little creature and every leaf they look at. And that's their path is a devotional path. And music and poetry and song may stimulate them in the right way. I've experienced a lot of each different path spontaneously. I mean, if you sit in meditation long enough, you're going to fall in love with everything. And if you don't feel anything in meditation but this peaceful aloofness, it's nothing. It's not even the first samadhi. And even when we're alone in that state and we're reading the scriptures and we're studying the mantras so perfectly and we become holier than thou and we treat people like dirt. It's just years away from the real thing really happening. In a way, I almost think the real meditation is total attachment. It's total bonding. It's bonding with greater and greater levels of the field. I mean, first you bond with the field of your own self, and then your environment. You know, it's very easy to bond with a tree, and then you start bonding with people. And the bonding is a connection. It's a total. See, samadhi means absorption. Absorption. It doesn't mean rejection, aloofness. So these are very. I mean, again, if I had known the pitfalls earlier, I could have reached higher states of consciousness sooner. And I might be even further ahead of where I am now because I practiced meditation the wrong way for many years, you know, rejecting people and just staying aloof and just waiting for God to show up, and it just never happened that way. In meditation, even when you do your practice, look for the God consciousness in the ordinary humanness. Feel the uniqueness of your own signature, of your own self. Don't try to be like the guru and, you know, shave your head and do your clothes like the guru dresses. Actually find out more and more what makes you feel the pureness of you. You know, the idea of no self, I mean, when Buddha says anatta, no self, he clarifies this in the Lankavatara Sutra that don't think that your uniqueness of self disappears in the field. It doesn't. Krishna says the same thing. It will become something completely different than your sense of self right now, because your self right now may or may not be in the small egg or very small auric field, a field of energy that's only a couple of feet beyond the body at best. That's where most auras are at right now. A very small percentage of the basic human aura goes, you know, 20 feet beyond the body even. And it just starts to fall off at a greater distance than that. In the samadhis, the absorption, the total bondedness with the field, you're so absorbed in the field that everything that lives and is connected to that field, you feel it in its purest sense. And it's shocking. Like when I was sitting at this Buddhist retreat and I looked at the people, I saw them as God sees them. They don't even see themselves in what I saw. If they did, they'd be crying, just so much beauty looking at each other. It's really, really challenging to look at a person when you see them the way God sees them. It's so beautiful. We're such amazing. Every one of us was created intentionally by the cosmos, by God. So we're not an accident. If any one of us feels rejected by our own parents, don't think the universe rejects you, because it made your parents who made you. You were not an accident. You were consciously and very carefully created. The universe doesn't make mistakes. Nature doesn't make mistakes. So you're not an accident. And the preciousness is heartbreaking when you see. When you're sitting there and you're in this very, your legs are hurting, your back is hurting, you're meditating, and then this happens, and you're, oh my God, you could fall in love with everybody on a very deep, deep level. And that's, the real masters hit that place. And they're in it all the time, and they go deeper and deeper and deeper into that. I mean, it's kind of ironic, isn't it? I mean, we want God to be our waiter. Could you get me this? Could you get me that? Could, you know, this is what I want. I want to manifest this. We're basically saying, God, you created all this, so can you serve me? And God loves to serve us, because God created us with so much intention, so much perfection of mind, that it says, I love you so much, I'm going to serve you. That's all I'm going to do. Because I'm already God blissed out. Now I want to see you how I see you. That's all God is doing, just so patiently. So patiently.
Beautiful. Well, David, we've just got about 15 minutes left in the show, and we've covered so much, and I love the topic of connection and pure compassion, and I'm wondering if there's... I actually wanted to ask you... I've been noticing, I consider myself a really compassionate person. I do care about other people, and I do my best to be kind and considerate and help whenever I can. But I notice as I'm walking down the beach each day that I see other people walking by, and I automatically have judgments about them. About their physical appearance, about their way they're walking, or the way they are interacting with other people. And I'm just wondering, do you, after so many years of meditation and these deep spiritual experiences, do you, because I think I'm unfortunately that's a pretty common occurrence for human beings. Do you still experience that kind of instant judgment?
I don't think about, you know, for example, if someone gives me a compliment or an insult, I don't even think about it. When I wake up in the morning, I don't think, you know, this is what I want for myself or that, or I simply am absorbed in something that's so intensely interesting to me, I'm absorbed in it. When I look at people, I just look at them, and I can feel so much of the field. Sometimes I'll be in a, you know, the supermarket, and a person's field will go by mine, and I'll just feel this really amazing tingling, and sometimes this beautiful energy, and it'll kind of trance me out a bit. And other times I'll feel somebody. If you become, this is a good question, because why do we judge? We judge the person because we felt something. This is what I'm trying to say. And we didn't just look at them and judge them. We're just having a dialogue about something we felt. And it, part of what we're doing, it's not judgment, it's just noticing, oh, I felt this in this person's presence. And it's not labeling or judging them and not seeing that as their limitation. And when we become, the first level of sensitivity is that we empathically, which means we feel other people's feelings. We're not just thinking it, we're actually feeling it. That's because our fields are brushing by each other. But the next level of realization in meditation is, if you feel something that's kind of terrible in another person, like a really bad quality, and it's even evident in their structure, the way they hold their face or the way they look, because they're radiating that feeling so much, and you go, oh, I've really noticed this. What the Buddha is saying is, don't notice, but don't notice. Just let it drift right through you, because when you see the true nature of that being, you will see them. And when you see them in that state, they don't see that. If they did, oh my God, they would be different. It's like seeing a person who's in the state of conflict. They are the conflict. They're an egomaniac even. And you notice that. But they also have this perfection in their soul. And you can actually see that too at the same time all that other stuff exists. So, again, I mean, this is the conflict thing. Oh, I just noticed this thing about this person. I shouldn't be like that. I should be like this. See, there's the mind. It already goes into conflict. When you're, the Buddha's meditation is notice. Just notice it. Arise, feel it, let it pass away. Arising and passing. Everything is arising and passing. This emotion bubbles up within me when I brush by this person's aura, and then it goes away. This feeling arises up in myself, and then it goes away. No feeling, emotion, or even spiritual experience is permanent. The only thing that's permanent, according to the Buddha, is the nirvana. It's the only permanent consciousness. It's happening all the time. Everything else, all the vicissitudes of life, all the emotions, they're all changing. Changing, changing, changing. The Buddha says, anicca, anicca, changing. But now, it's amazing, in the Gospel of Thomas, Jesus says, he who knows the beginning shall know the end and shall not experience death. He who knows the beginning shall know the end and shall not experience death. So what he's saying is, who was with you in the beginning when you were born? Who was looking through Marie's eyes when she was born? It's pure consciousness. And that same pureness of consciousness experienced the vicissitudes, experienced the emotions. But the pure witness is the same space that's been looking through your eyes since the beginning, the middle, and the end. That doesn't die. It cannot be extinguished. It's the inextinguishable, the pure, pureness of consciousness. What causes us to suffer is we absorb pureness of consciousness in impermanent phenomena, pleasure, pain, this and that. And when this pleasure goes away, we get upset, oh, I want that again, and I can't have it. So we get into a conflict about the fact that it passed. Buddha is saying, because it's impermanent by nature, this is true non-attachment. Feel the feeling explode inside of you. Feel the love in the tears, and then it passes. Okay, so this is not nirvana, but it sure was beautiful. But the idea is, don't cling to anything. And also, don't suppress anything. Let it all just keep flowing out. So when we walk by a person and we notice something, oh, I just noticed this. But when you really get deep, you'll notice the most incredibly beautiful thing inside of that person. In fact, even a person who's stuck in a hell realm, because they're choosing to be there, because they want to fight, because they want to be right, and they want to beat the other guy up until the end of time, Buddhas can go down into those realms, compassionate Buddhas, and they don't experience any of the suffering in the hell realm at all, yet they're seeing it. They're seeing them all shooting and killing each other and slicing each other's throats and heads off, but they don't feel any of it because all they see is the true nature of that being. And so that's the deeper level. On the surface, yes, you see the suffering. When a person suffers too much, it can be very harmful to the soul level, especially if they eventually want revenge. It's really dangerous to suffer too much to the point that you're going to want revenge. No matter how good that person may have been at birth, no matter how good of a person they were, Jesus says in the Gnostic Gospels, learn how to suffer so you shall not suffer. Learn how to suffer. Suffering is designed to give birth to compassion for other suffering. When you have compassion for somebody else's suffering, your own suffering goes away. Because compassion is such a flame, it extinguishes the suffering in your own self. So the only way to get rid of the suffering in our own self is to, if we look at the person and they're walking by, first we feel their suffering, we feel their pain, so the mind makes a quick little judgment. But then, if we see, oh, that person is like this because they suffered, and really take the time to feel the compassion for them, they'll change in the presence of your compassion, and you will change. Your suffering will go away. St. Francis of Assisi said, every suffering is an opportunity to experience compassion. And compassion extinguishes your suffering. So the person who's aloof in meditation, no compassion, sorry, that's your problem. They're sitting there, they're really stiff, and no, I'm aloof, I'm not attached. You know, it's so, you know, you can suffer all you want, and I just don't feel anything. Well, this person can do that, and go ahead, keep doing it. Tell me in 10 years what you feel. Keep doing it. Maybe it'll work for you, I don't know. It didn't work for me.
And David, did you find yourself, because the first thing that came to mind when you said that is that when you're aloof and you're kind of like, well, I'm a jerk too, get over it, that's your problem. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, you can continue doing that, but at the end of that period, my guess is that you're going to come out of that meditative state and realize that there's no one around. You're isolated.
Well, that's it. But the presence of compassion is, while it's invisible, it's doing its work. You know, if you hang around the Dalai Lama long enough, you know, it's going to hit you like a ton of bricks, how much compassion is coming from Avalokiteshvara through him. It's very powerful. And we know from the science of measuring fields and auras that it's doing its work. The best teachers I've ever met, like the Mother Mira is my favorite teacher on the planet. She has this word. I just get so blasted sitting with her for 2 hours, I can't even believe it. I mean, I'm literally last time just crying from the ecstasy because there's so much ecstasy, I can't contain it. It won't stay in my body. It's just too big. And she didn't say a word. And she has this straight face. The real masters, they're not laughing and smiling all the time. That's the first couple of samadhis, if they're even there. When the master's aura gets so big, it goes you know, to the fourth even. Even a fourth level master, which the Buddhists call Turiya, is the fourth. It's so beyond the body that there can't be an expression on the face anymore. The faculties of body don't work. So you'll see a very limp look. You know, sometimes you look at a Tibetan master and the face is kind of sullen and drawn downwards, but just keep meditating with them, and you know, like trying to remember his name. Kala Rinpoche visited Vancouver, and I saw him. He has kind of a permanent, subtle smile. Think of the subtle smile on the Mona Lisa. That is the smile, the subtlety of a master. And the more the field goes beyond the body, there is this quality. I've looked at pictures of Zen masters, and I can see this guy, he's the real thing. This guy is really in the state, and this guy, you can see, is still a beginner. And so the early students, they want a master who's happy and laughing and rolling around with them. And that's good. That's nice because, you know, we need this. The yogis say ananda bliss is the first, and it hits the body. It's a physical bliss. It will bliss out your limbs, the top of your head. You'll feel kind of a burning sensation on the crown chakra. It's still inside the body. But the masters that are way beyond the body, like the Mother Mira, you don't see a flinch on her face. But man, does she transmit. Holy cow. I've never seen anything like her.
Well, David, we just have 2 minutes left in the show.
2 minutes.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that you have a film on the secrets of the Mona Lisa. And you can find out more information about David's film, that film, and all of his films at voiceentertainment.net. And, yeah, we could go on talking more and more, but what would you like to say to close the show, David?
I guess I don't know what to say in 2 minutes. So, you know, I'm so grateful to share, and I'm... with these observers and observed, and this is a relationship, and I'm just so grateful to you and your show and Namaste Publishing and Eckhart Tolle and all he's done. And I'm grateful to all, we're so lucky to have so many good teachers who are teaching so many people at so many different levels right now in the world, and I bow to all my teachers that I've learned from, and I'm so, so glad that the East collided with the West.
Beautiful.
It was a big collision that was, you know, when I was in India, one of the Dalai Lama's Tenzins was having lunch with me, and he said, Dalai Lama actually believes that it's possible that the reason the Chinese invaded Tibet was to bring Buddhism out of the high mountains and bring it into the, people would have so much compassion for the suffering of the Tibetan people, they would all learn about Buddhism. And before that, they wouldn't. So he said, it's a terrible thing that happened, but maybe this is why it happened.
Beautifully said, David. Well, I hope that we're able to speak again. I know you're going to be very busy as a new daddy soon, but maybe...
Yeah, that'll be new. It's going to get me right in my body.
Maybe once things have settled down a little bit and you've adjusted to that, we can speak again.
We'll speak again later, yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, David. Have a great day.
You too.
Okay. Bye-bye. So, I wish we could continue speaking with him all day, but we're running out of time. We've got about 30 seconds left in the show. Thank you so much for being with us. Please visit namastepublishing.com. And again, David Sarita's website is voiceentertainment.net. Be well. We love you. Namaste.
Thank you for joining with us for this hour of Namaste Radio. For further spiritual insights and sharing, please join us in Namaste Global Community at namastepublishing.com. If you enjoyed the show, please add Namaste Radio as a friend, favorite the show, and tell someone about it. Sharing this show is a precious gift that's completely free. Thank you. May you enjoy each moment of your day. Namaste.